Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay, and this evening we're dealing with part two, the professionals, contracts, equity, law, mortgage, loans, and justice. We are, I still don't think it's possible for me to put everything out here for you, even in two broadcasts, because there is so much that you need to know, and there's so many pros breaking this thing down for you, so you can clearly understand what's going on and how to go about dealing with it. So what we're going to do here this evening is we're going to bring it from a whole different perspective, okay? So make sure that when you listen to this broadcast, make sure you got your pencil and paper handy so you can write this stuff down. If there are websites mentioned, whatever it is that's mentioned, you want to make sure that you are right.
Moving
down
the burdens,
okay,
of debt gives us a freedom unmatched. Peace of mind is something that's very vital to our health. Not only do we want to concentrate on growing our own food and contributing to nutrition, but we also want to free our mind from the burden of stress. Stress is a killer. Go to www.newdebtelimination.com. Look at the items we have there. Before making any selections, you can give me a call. If you have problems with your student loan, if you got a situation with the Internal Revenue Service, mortgage, or whatever it is, go to newdebtelimination.com. Contact me, Tahaka Amana El Bay, 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Remove the burden of debt. Freeing up capital to make investments may not be as hard as you think. But those of you who have Facebook accounts, send me a friend request over there on Facebook and LinkedIn to Tahaka Amana El Bay. That's T-A-R-A-H-A-K-A. Amana is A-M-A-A-N-A and then E-L and of course B-E-Y. And you'll be able to see the actual documents clearly showing you how I was able to cancel my mortgage and property taxes contracts, and that way I have freed up capital for investments. To get the apparatus to do this with, go to www.newdebtelimination.com. That's www.newdebtelimination.com. It's not as hard as you think. Send a friend request on Facebook, and I'll grant that request, and you can actually see the documents for yourself. Peace.
Okay, Morris. Now, what we're going to do is, in the beginning, starting off, right straight off the top, we're going to deal with where is money. What are banks? What happened to the real money? Okay, we're going to deal with what happened to the real money. What happened? Because we got some gentlemen here that pretty big politicians, and they're questioning these people as to what happened. Do you have real money or not? And we want to see the responses that we're going to give from these people. And we're going to be dealing with the following questions this evening. What is credit? What should we say in court? Just how do we win in court? What role does contract law play? What happened to the real money? And what are banks? Now, these are just a few of the things that we're going to deal with here this evening. So hang on every word. Keep in mind that the archives are now officially available, and all the packages that are over there on newdebtelimination.com comes along with that library. Okay? All right. So we're going to run this here, and it's only going to be a little over 6 minutes. Hold on and listen to this one.
Mr. Chairman, I tell you, knowing that you for many years had picked up more and more support for your bill, legislation to audit the Federal Reserve, I wish, truthfully, and it has nothing to do with you gentlemen here today, but I'm telling you that the distrust out here by the American people is as deep and severe as I've ever seen, and it does not only Congress itself, not only the administration, but the Federal Reserve is just at this point at a very low ebb as it relates to trust. And I am not talking about you personally. You're two men of high integrity, I know that. But right now, the Federal Reserve is not held in high esteem by many people in this country. I'll yield back.
I thank the gentleman. I have a few short questions, and then we'll finish up. One thing is, on a follow-up on what Mr. Jones says, is the confidence is very low. But when you speak of independence, and I understand your terms, and I disagree with the need for that, but I understand it. But what people hear when you say independence, they hear secrecy. You know, you're going to keep it from us. And like the point I made at the beginning, the SEC is to pressure companies to reveal information, where the Federal Reserve does the opposite. They want, no, we can't tell anything because it might disturb the markets. But I do have one question. During the crisis or any time that you're aware of, has the Federal Reserve or Treasury participated in any gold swaps arrangements?
The Federal Reserve does not own any gold at all. We have not owned gold since 1934. So we have not engaged in any gold swaps.
But it appears on your balance sheet that you hold gold.
What appears on our balance sheet is gold certificates. When we turned before 1934, the Federal Reserve did own gold. We turned that over by law to the Treasury and received in return for that gold certificate.
If the Treasury entered into, because under the Exchange Stabilization Fund, I would assume they probably have the legal authority to do it, they wouldn't be able to do it then because you have the securities for essentially all the gold?
No, we have no interest in the gold that is owned by the Treasury. We have simply an accounting document that is called gold certificates that represents the value at a statutory rate
and still
that we gave to the Treasury in 1930.
And still measured at $42 an ounce, which makes no sense whatsoever. But, you know, the conventional wisdom today says that gold is really not money. We don't want it to be money. I mean, if you're for the gold standard, there's something wrong with you. Yet we hold the gold, and you know there have been suggestions made, and I've sort of encouraged the suggestions. You know, if gold is not money and it's an asset, and you don't even use it because it's on your balance sheets, and you don't even use it at the real value, would you have a position on this? Why shouldn't the Treasury just sell the gold, give it back to the people? The people had it at one time. Let the people have it. Would you have any objection to that? Would you advise us and say, no, that's not good. We ought to hold the gold. Do you think holding the gold is a good idea or a bad idea?
So I have no position on that at all. That's clearly
no position.
Treasury. It's a matter for the Treasury. It's not within the purview of the Federal Reserve.
Mr. Baxter, would you have an opinion?
My opinion is I agree with Mr. Alfres.
No position. Well, It's amazing because I've asked questions to the Federal Reserve, the members of the board for years, and whether it's been Mr. Greenspan, I can't recall exactly what I've asked Mr. Bernanke, but it's always, well, no, we have to hold on to these assets. But if it's not money and we don't need it, we're not going on a gold standard, I mean, I would think that they shouldn't be holding it. The reason I ask that is, the truth is gold is money, and people don't throw it away, and people do cling to it. But I would be, really, there's a lot of people who suspect, because of this lack of transparency, that there's been a tremendous amount of gold swaps and loans made, and central banks sold a lot of gold after these the last 10 years. A lot of the gold has left the West and has gone to the East. And the central banks that now have positive trade balances, they buy up the gold. There has to be a message in there and a significance, even for those who don't want to have restraints of gold. It has to be a message out there that we should look at, because we're in a financial mess, and it has to do with our monetary system, and it's being reflected today in rising prices and a weak economy, and just printing all this money isn't doing any good. All this stuff that's been done for 3 years, and you look at the economic statistics now, they're horrible. And these people who lost their jobs, they're still unemployed. The people who bought stocks in the year 2000, if they held on, they probably haven't even broken even. They probably lost purchasing power. So eventually, I know this is off the subject a little bit, but it is reflected only in that we don't know exactly what goes on. And people, when they don't know, then they get suspicious, and they say, well, it's kept secret from us. Why aren't we allowed to know? And we just march on. And the type of dollars we're talking about, and when we hear about this money going to central banks and banks that Gaddafi was a part owner in, I mean, this stuff is really stirs up the emotions of a lot of people. But I do appreciate you being here, and I know that there'll be a lot of questions. There will be written questions submitted, and we'd appreciate your cooperation and send us our answers back. And I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman.
This hearing is adjourned.
All right, there you have it. Members of the Federal Reserve outright said the Federal Reserve does not have any money. We have no gold. We have gold certificates. In other words, we have paper claiming we got some money. But we do not have any money, and he went on to say, we have not had gold since 1934. Okay, well, what is this thing people are hollering about Fort Knox, and why are there is being guarded? For what? It is to give the illusion that the United States still has money. So therefore, what I would like everybody to do that's listening to this broadcast, if you have a $1 bill, if that's all you got, take it out, get you a magnifying glass, and look over it front and back, and look for the word money on it, anywhere, any other greenbacks that you got, look for the word money on it. And if you find the word money on it, you can be a very rich man, because you can sue the Federal Reserve. All you got to do is go to YouTube, get this plug, and put it on a disc and send it to the Treasury Department. Tell them to give you $100,000 to call this thing off, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 pieces of paper. But they can't give you the money now, because the representatives of the Federal Reserve just got through saying, we don't have no gold. We ain't had no gold since 1934. Okay. So when you hear people hollering about, you owe me money. No, man, I couldn't possibly owe you no money. There is no money. He robbed me. He took my money. Well, he did. He took your debt, but he didn't take your money. But he couldn't. So there is no money. So if there is no money, what we have to understand is how is it possible for us to stay afloat? And believe me, we floating on fumes. However, if you got something that somebody believes in, let's just take, for instance, we're going to put this in a nutshell for you. And the brothers, you know what I'm talking about. Remember one thing, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. If you go to a barber shop to get a haircut, there's a guy in there that's going to cut your hair. And that guy messes around and messes up your hair. You don't have any more confidence in this guy. And you are definitely not going back for a second haircut. He done. He through. He never will be able to cut your hair again. No more in life. And what if you go to the store, you give you the store clerk your money, your paper, your debt, and you can go in there and pick up what items you want, and you can walk out. But what happens when confidence in the currency or the debt notes that you give him breaks down? And you walk up to the counter and you say, well, I'd like to get so-and-so and so-and-so. And first thing he's going to say to you, well, we don't accept any U.S. dollars now. What you got? What else you got? Because we're not going to take no more paper. Do you have any metal? Do you have anything else other than that? When that occurs, and the reason I'm telling you that, because this has actually occurred inside the United States. I mean, in different parts of the world. You got places over in other countries that you can go to and try to buy something, and they'll tell you right straight off, you go, no, we don't accept no American dollar. No. Now, I know this, because I had a friend who traveled all over the world, he's an emerging Marine, and he'd come back and he'd tell me. Is there places that I've been, they do not accept American dollars, period. If you ain't got no rubles, you ain't no douchemans, you ain't got no yen, but man, you pull out American dollars, they run you out of the store. No, we don't want that over here. Now, imagine that occurring inside the United States. You see, a country that doesn't have anything solid backing up his currency, is going to have a serious problem in the United States. So, and then if something like that happens and the world lose confidence in the American dollar, because we got countries right now, China and India, they're buying up all the silver and gold. They're stockpiling it. And then what they're going to do is they can easily come out and say, well, look, we no longer accept any American currency from you. Okay, they go to impose. They go to impose. You know, we cannot import anything from them unless we give them something other than American currency. So what's going to have to happen is somebody going to have to come up with something. Believe me, they're working on something now. It's called a world currency. World currency. But for those people who are constantly not paying attention, you're not looking at the indicators of what's going on, and we're steady trying to stockpile this currency instead of, if you're stockpiling the currency, exchange the currency for real money. You know, get rid of it. And another thing that you want to do, you definitely want to relieve yourself of the tentacles of debt. You have to do that, because that's most of us don't know what a margin call is. On the stock market, there's a thing called a margin call. A margin call is when you have borrowed into a stock, or you had invested into a stock, you got this money all tied up into the stock, and we'll say the stock ain't going nowhere, you're not making any money, you're not investing any more money, and everything just tied up. Well, it comes time that you had to pay for the stock. And when they call in the margin on that, it's time for you to pay now, You don't have any money. We're gonna have to confiscate your collateral. Okay, whatever it is, house, car, boat, it don't matter what it is. We got to confiscate your collateral because that's what happened in the market of 1929 when they start calling in the debt. The banks start collapsing the debt, calling in the debt. I loan you $30,000 at the bank. You put up your house as collateral. You put up your automobile. You put up your boat. You put up your motorcycle. It's time for you to pay the loan back. If you can't pay the loan back today, we're coming out to confiscate everything that we held as collateral as payment for the loan that we gave you. That's the way this thing goes. So the first step is to realize what's going on. The second thing is to start removing yourself from the tentacles of debt. Get out of it. Whatever it is, you got it. You owe something somewhere, you need to get rid of it. Get out of it and get yourself so they won't come and start confiscating your stuff and you hot and they ain't got nothing. Now's the time right now to pay attention and start doing something constructively to save yourself. Now, what we're going to do now is we're going to put this thing in a nutshell. And what I really wanted to bring here this evening is best understood on video. And so what I did was I put that on my wall on Facebook, and I'm going to be putting it in other places, including the Master Library, which shows you how to collapse the birth bond from start to finish. Okay, that's on my wall right over there at on Facebook. You go over there, just scroll down, you'll see the little thing. It's called Removing the Chains, the Invisible Chains. And it step by step so you can see how to do this right here and get this thing done. And it would not, I really wanted to put it on here, but it wouldn't have done me any justice to put it here because it's an illustrated thing so you can see how to do this step by step. Okay? But it's right there on Facebook. Send me a free request at Amana Bay on Facebook. If you own the old Facebook page, which is Tahaka Amana L Bay, just go on my wall, my Facebook wall, and scroll down and you'll see the little video there, and I put it in all my groups as well. You'll see the little video there say remove the invisible chains, removing the invisible chains. Okay? All right. Now, we're going to get down into the nuts and bolts and wiggle pins of this thing some more. And we got Mark Stevens going to come up with some things to show you exactly what to say inside the courtroom. We got Green Frog with us. We also got Mary Croft. We're going to find a little bit of that. And we got some Gordon Hall telling you about the A process, B process on that contract law. We'll try to do as much damage as we can. So I hope you got your paper and pencil handy and so that we can roll with this thing. And it's one more thing that we want to deal with as well, and it's called the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. This is millions and millions and millions, and in some cases billions of dollars, that's being hoarded away, stolen, stuffed in private accounts and all of these things, and the money belongs to you, okay? And there is a way to deal with that, and there are people that's actually doing that. And inside the United States, we're going to see if we can get that to that today also. And if not, I may have to come up with part three. I'm going to try to get as much of this stuff out as I possibly can so you can see what's going on and see the solution to the problems of what's going on. So y'all hold your hat for a second, okay?
Talk Show. Recorded live.
Hey, everybody. It's Thursday, September 27, 2012, and we're back again. And this time we have Gordon Hall, who is on the phone with us tonight, and he's going to be unveiling the new B process for his administrative process, which, quite frankly, folks, is kicking butt. Students are getting the successes. They're standing up in court, standing up for themselves, and they're winning. So, Gordon, welcome to the call.
Hi, Tad. How are you?
Pretty good. It's good to have you on the call. Well, was Jack able to make it tonight?
He's on a webinar, so we're a little bit out of luck there. He's on a webinar this evening, and okay. So we couldn't get him.
darn. All right. Well, so some of these people already are familiar with you and what you do, and some of those people aren't, so I just want to fill you in on that. Folks, if you could go ahead and hit star 6 to mute out so I don't have to do it for you, that would be great. Star 6 to mute out, please.
You're probably going to have to do it that all the time.
That's all I hear. Volume is real low.
All right. Okay, so so Gordon, go ahead and continue. You've got the A process in your administrative processes, and that is kind of the paperwork side of things. And
well, they're all paperwork sides. We talked about this, Tad. You have your A process and a B process. Your A process coincides with Matthew 18, verse 15. You go to your brother privately, do an administrative process, get his agreement, and now that's done. You take that judgment and you go take a witness, adjudication group, whatever, adjudication society, notary, whatever, however you're going to do that. And you do another administrative process using a witness this time. And it's the judgment that comes out of that B process that gets filed as the beginning of a C process, the filing of that foreign judgment or registering of that foreign judgment into that court and served on the other party. It creates a collateral attack, or they're going to have to resolve that. So, cool situation. Otherwise, we've got a public side that we've been doing what we call an X process, which is just going in on the public side and going direct to the prosecution in criminal cases, appointing him fiduciary, and again giving him a payment instrument to discharge the debt and with some instructions. And it's been pretty wild. So you actually got essentially almost four processes that you're doing here.
Wow.
Now, didn't you talk a little bit, Pat, earlier that you wanted to discuss a little bit what's the situation with our this gentleman, Tim Turner?
Well, Tim Turner and what he's been doing in general, and those that have used some of his processes, and I know that apparently there's a few people that are directly around him that may be facing arrest, and I think the issue is his bond system and using them for the IRS. I think it's the IRS that's really pushing this thing.
Well, maybe, is it? Well, what is it? Could it possibly be? Let me ask you something. You know, we talk about, ladies and gentlemen, we propound certain principles that underlie your conduct. You're either under man or you're under God. Do we agree with that, Tad?
Yes.
Under man, is it proper to argue, go to court, get attorneys, have controversies, be in dispute?
I think that's generally what they want you to do.
That's right. Under God, Matthew 5:25 tells us, agree with our adversary quickly. And we know God doesn't want us to fight and argue. Therefore, in my opinion, in my partner's opinion, Brandon Adams and Jack Smith, we're proponents of this system of government under God. And if you're going to fight and you're going to argue and you're going to explain and you're going to justify your position, you're under man and you will get what you have coming and you're not going to like it. Now, Tim is a very vociferous individual, very contentious, is he not, is my understanding?
He can be.
Okay, well, either you are or you aren't. Has our friend Tim leaned up courts and judges?
Sounds like it. Yeah, I have.
Okay, I've read some stuff where he leaned one up for $52 billion or something. We talked that, you know, all contracts got to be in good faith. That's hardly in good faith. Leaning up a judge is, like, not an acceptable situation. They have a right to attempt to trick you. Test your faith. Are you going to be under God or are you going to be under man?
Now, wait a minute, Gordon. What do you mean a judge has a right to try to trick you?
Aren't you to be tested? Isn't that what a trial is, a test?
You mean he tried to trick?
Ladies and gentlemen, you're gonna, we just did a case out in California, a big civil case. We got four major guys on the defense side with their corporations, adding another two or three defendants, so about seven defendants. And we have an ex-partner that's suing them all. We did several administrative processes, resolved the matter, and go away, didn't charge our brother. Not too long ago, back in July, the judge told the plaintiffs that they're going to have to file a third amended complaint and do it correctly, so this is how ridiculous it's getting. They never did file that complaint. The judge issued out a judgment on a non-filed complaint. They never served anybody. They never had a proof of service in that anybody got served. Yet a judgment issued out of court against the defendants. And the defendants got a hold of them and said, what's going on? I thought we were doing good. I said, you are. You've won the case. Do you really believe that the judge has issued out a valid judgment in light of our notice of fraud on the court, failure to provide a proof of service, et cetera? Failure of serving any third amended complaint on any of the seven defendants, and affidavits put in accordingly. And they couldn't understand it. And their old friendly attorney was calling them, look at this, look at that, you got to do something, you can't just let this go. So Jack and I had a conversation with this attorney and the clients, like, let's see, what's today, last Friday. And the attorney said, you know, blah, 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 and this has got to be dealt with. And I said to him, has there been anything adverse happened to any of the clients, any bank account attached or seized, any piece of property, one thing? He says, no. I said, what makes you think the judge is going to enforce an invalid judgment then, or that they're even going to try it? In light of some other things that were there. I just think they are. That's our experience with it. I said, well, that's your choice. Of the four guys, three of them went with the attorney. The attorney put in their declarations. They tried to pressure the fourth guy who refused and stuck with us. On Tuesday, about 72 hours later, a very interesting judgment was delivered to one of the defendants regarding his piece of property to his manager. And it named almost everybody. Now, the previous judgment that came out named everybody. This judgment that came out and backdated into July eliminated our guy that didn't put in a declaration, didn't get an attorney, and didn't fight. Hold on just a moment.
Holding.
All right. Very interesting. So the other three guys can't hardly believe it. They go, well, how did that happen? Why aren't you named? He says, the only thing I can tell you is Gordon and Jack were right, and you guys are in fighting. Now, that attorney had an interesting meeting today. He was in court today. And my guy tells me that he's telling the judge, and the judge is looking at all the paperwork and going, I can't imagine how this judgment got issued. There wasn't even a default put in until 2 weeks after the judgment was issued. That didn't make any sense. So the judge was having a lot of trouble there. Give me a break. And my clients were really upset. How come you told us this would be over? I said, what do you want me to do about a judge and a crooked attorney? Except that it never happened. But you made it come into being by arguing it, and we told you not to. You know, this game of law is so subtle and difficult for most people to understand. And one of the things we tell people, Ted, they don't know when they win. Now, our friend Tim Turner, we say that the come from's everything, and you ask me, what do I think of that? Well, bonds are probably just fine. However, when you put in a $300 billion bond or $100 billion, isn't it a little ridiculous?
Well, it does.
I don't care if it's ridiculous or not. A bond is just nothing but a promise to pay. A promise to pay, they specify someone to do or not do a specified thing. How can that be false? I promise to pay you $5,000. How can that be a false bond or a wrong bond? It can't. Hold on a minute.
Okay, Morris, we're back. Now, that was Ms. Gordon Hall putting a little contract law and giving you a little remedy inside that courtroom. But we're going to take it a little step further. Keep in mind the number to dial into this broadcast. If you got questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand. The number is 310-982-4184. If you got any questions, go ahead and raise your hand. We're going to go down here, and we're going to deal with a little Mark Stevens. And he's going to be giving us some very, very important information on how to quickly dissolve some things inside of that courtroom for those people who are, if you find yourself in there, we try to teach you how to do things to keep from ever going there. But if you find yourself in there, if you got on a traffic ticket or something, we're going to deal with that and show you how to quickly. And keep in mind, you should have some paper and pencil. If you can listen to this broadcast over and over, this will be Mark Stevens. You can also catch him over there on YouTube and learn some of
this.
Hi,
I'm Mark Stevens, author of Adventures in Legaland and host of the No Stay Project, the only show on the air dedicated to bringing about a voluntary society. You can hear that every Saturday afternoon from 5 to 7 p.m. Central Time and 2 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time on We the People Radio Network. That's WTPRN.com. Again, that's WTPRN.com. What I want to talk about today, civil traffic tickets, beating civil traffic tickets, getting them kicked out. The thing I want to point out, though, is all traffic warrants, it doesn't matter who or what, you know, who's running them, they're all scams. It has nothing to do about protection, has nothing to do about justice. It's about separating you from your money. That's all they're there to do. And you'll find that out if you are unfortunate enough to have to go there. You see, most people, their interaction with government is through traffic tickets. We all know somebody who's got a traffic ticket. Nobody wants to get it. And what they do is they set the fine low enough so that you'll just pay it. They go, oh, this isn't worth my time. I'm not going to take time off from work. It's only a couple $100. I'll just pay it. That's a mind game. They're doing this on purpose. It's part of the whole advertising and public relations of these comment called traffic courts. They want you to just pay it because if more people fought it, the whole system would collapse. Either that or before it collapsed, what they would do is they would keep lowering the fines. And they would keep lowering the fines until they got that happy medium to where people would just pay it, which is, of course, what they want. I mean, why go through the whole charade of a trial if you could just have people send the money in? I wouldn't just pay it because as I'm going to go through here, and it's not some conspiracy theory crap, okay, then you can verify all this. You'll see that no traffic ticket has any validity whatsoever. They're just part of a scam. So it doesn't matter what they're actually accusing me of, the ticket has no validity whatsoever, even under their little codes. So what I talk about a lot is the issue of standing, because, and this is just one of many ways of showing that a traffic ticket has no validity, but it's a big one. It's a very important one. If I can show that the ticket, that the plaintiff has no standing to complain against me, well, then the court has no subject matter jurisdiction, and the case has to be thrown out. So it doesn't matter what I'm being actually accused of if they can't show standing. So this is why I press this issue so much. It's a very big issue. Again, it's only one of many issues to show that traffic tickets are just part of a larger scam, and that they have no validity whatsoever. So one of the things I want to point out, that if you learn anything from the video, is that a ticket, let's say a ticket, is not synonymous with a complaint, with a cause of action. See, they want you to believe that a cause of action and a ticket are exactly the same thing, because then they've already won, they've got you here. Because, well, you know, most people just assume, well, there's a valid cause of action here, I'll just pay it, or it's not worth my time, I pay it. But boy, you open up a whole can of worms then when you start questioning whether the complaint presents a valid cause of action. And a cause of action is a very specific thing legally. In fact, any attorney will tell you that. They don't want you to discuss that. The one thing that judges and prosecutors and especially the police, they don't want you talking about cause of action or standing. And they'll even let you think that doesn't even apply. We'll show you that it does. So before we get into the issue of standing, to determine how somebody gets standing in an American court, you have to know what the court is for. I mean, why do we have courts? Why do we have government? Now, I know this is all public relations, but this just goes to show that the ticket has no validity, even under their little code. You find the purpose of government in the Declaration of Independence in most state constitutions. In Arizona, for example, it's Article 2, Section 2, and it states that governments are established to protect and maintain individual rights. Okay, now stop laughing. So the governments are established to protect and maintain individual rights. So this is why we have the government. Now, we know courts are part of the government. So the purpose of the court is to protect and maintain individual rights, of course. So what is the court's jurisdiction? Well, the court's jurisdiction is limited, of course, to its purpose. The purpose is to protect and maintain individual rights. So the jurisdiction of any court is going to be limited to the protection and maintenance of individual rights. That's basic common sense. So then for a plaintiff to have standing in that same court, in an American court, the plaintiff has to allege the violation of a legal right because the court's jurisdiction is based on protecting and maintaining individual rights. So to have standing, they have to allege that. And you can go into any number of court cases. They're consistent, believe it or not, with this. Of course, they don't like to hear this in a traffic court. Raines versus Byrd. Standing is a necessary component of subject matter jurisdiction. Well, you have to have subject matter jurisdiction even in a traffic case. It states that standing is perhaps the most important of the jurisdictional doctrines. Standing represents a jurisdictional requirement which remains open to review at all stages of the litigation. And in the Supreme Court of the United States, again, Allen versus Wright, this is where you get into the elements of standing. The requirement of standing, however, has a core component derived directly from the Constitution. A plaintiff must allege personal injury fairly traceable to the defendant's allegedly unlawful conduct and likely to be redressed by the request of relief. So you have to have the injury, which is the invasion of a legal right. So we know that they're claiming that it's a civil traffic ticket. Let's say I didn't have a seatbelt on and they file a civil action against me. Well, do they allege the violation of a legal right? Is there any injury? It says, again, they must allege personal injury. Well, was the police officer alleging personal injury? Does the prosecutor allege personal injury of the so-called plaintiff? No. So now if the courts, now this is subject matter jurisdiction, so for a plaintiff to have standing, they have to allege the violation of a legal right. Once they do that, then the court can have subject matter jurisdiction. But here we see there is no violation of legal right, so there couldn't be any subject matter jurisdiction because the court is limited, and the purpose of the court is to what? That's right, to protect and maintain individual rights. So you see right off the bat, no driver's license or no seatbelt or or even speeding. Not that I'm advocating people traveling at a speed that's not reasonable and prudent, but 5, 10, 12 miles an hour over the speed limit probably isn't really endangering anybody. So you see that there's no validity whatsoever to any of those tickets. And that's on just this one issue alone. And if you think that this isn't a serious issue, that the government attorneys don't take this seriously, you can just look at a recent case where the NSA was sued by, I believe it was the ACLU. And that was the main issue that they raised, that they hadn't shown standing. They couldn't show a personal injury. Well, that applies. Well, okay. Well, standing applies across the board, even to civil traffic cases, because we know that the government was established to what? Protect and maintain individual rights. So that's what the jurisdiction is limited to. So there is a very, it's been a very effective way, and it shows you that no traffic ticket has any validity whatsoever. So in the next video, what we'll discuss is how to impeach a witness, which is typically in a traffic case, you only have one witness, it's the police officer. And I can go through how you can impeach him by asking only two questions. Some cases, you ask him even one question, and the judge would be more than happy to say he's incompetent to testify. But that's in the next video. Until then, I'm Mark Stevens. Go to my website. It's adventuresinlegalland.com.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Mark Stevens, author of Adventures in Legaland, and this is part two of Beating Civil Traffic Tickets. And what I'm going to discuss today is how to impeach a witness, a government witness, by asking only two questions. And typically when you get a traffic ticket, the only witness against you is a police officer. It's just basically your word against his. And as the accuser, see, a lot of people may say, well, these questions aren't appropriate for the police officer. Well, that's just going in and showing that the officer's not competent to testify. He wrote the ticket. He's supposed to be able to answer questions and supposed to have a right to confront your accuser and demand the nature and cause of the charges and proceedings. And you're supposed to be able to question the police officer or any witness on prior testimony, whether it's written or oral. And what he puts on the ticket is written testimony. He's making an allegation against you and you're supposed to have every right to confront him and question him on it. They don't like you to ask questions because, as you'll see, it's very easy to show that the officer has no idea what he's talking about. They don't teach him these things, and even if he could answer the two questions, it doesn't help him. It just digs a deeper hole for them. And to show that, I want to just restate from the last video why you have government, because it forms the basis of the questions. And the public relations is, and we know this is all bull, we know this isn't true, but it's just propaganda, is that the government was created to protect and maintain individual rights. And you can find that in several state constitutions and the Declaration of Independence. So from there, we know that the jurisdiction of the court is, of course, limited to protecting and maintaining individual rights. Therefore, for there to be a case or controversy, as the courts have consistently held, there has to be the violation of someone's rights and damage. So the police officer, like everyone else, is required to file a valid cause of action, because without a valid cause of action, there is no standing and the court acquires no subject matter jurisdiction and cannot proceed against you, or anyone for that matter. So the question is to have him impeached, and what I mean by impeach is just to show that he's legally disqualified from testifying, that his testimony is inadmissible against me, you, or just whoever happens to be the defendant in that case. It doesn't mean he's removed from office, though that would be really good. That would be spectacular. However, that's not what it means. It just means he's not qualified to testify, and legally the judge has no discretion to accept his testimony, so it's got to be thrown out, and including his prior testimony, which would be the ticket. So the two questions are this. I like to give the police officer a copy of the ticket. I'll hand him a copy and ask him, did you file a valid cause of action against me? Now, of course, he's going to have to say yes, and they usually allow him to answer that question because it's pretty obvious. If he doesn't have a valid cause of action, there's no standing, and the court has no subject matter jurisdiction, and the case has to be thrown out because the court is established to protect and maintain individual rights. The second question, the follow-up, that will cause usually both attorneys representing the police officer to jump out of their chairs. And the question is, how many elements are in a valid cause of action? And usually his attorneys will jump out of the chair yelling, objection, calls for a legal conclusion, the witness is incompetent to testify. Now, he could say he's unable to testify. They'll say it's outside the scope of his expertise. It means the same thing. He is not qualified to testify to those matters. But they allowed him to answer the first question. That's okay, because it helps their case. But once you ask him to explain what he said, now they've got a problem with it. What they don't understand is that the judge will always sustain the objection, which is exactly what I'm looking for. Which means the witness is incapable or unable or incompetent to testify, which now requires the judge to strike all the testimony. And it's that simple. Doesn't mean the case is going to get thrown out, because again, traffic courts are scams ran by criminals. Yeah, they wear robes, they wear suits, but they're criminals nonetheless. But it's just that simple to be able to impeach a government witness.
Okay, Moses, we're back. I hope you got those two little pieces, little tidbits. Did you file a cause of action against me? How many points are in a valid cause of action? That is kind of rough. But you must also have the remainder of your artillery back, because they're going to keep in mind the whole thing is about separating you from your purse. You didn't cut on your blinker, you owe me money. You didn't come to a complete stop at the stop sign, you owe me money. You look suspicious, you owe me money. It was six guys in this car, they had on, all had on hats and sunglasses, you owe me money. Your tag is out of date, you owe me money. You were speeding, you owe me money. You know, you go into the courtroom, well, we got to make sure that we collect the money. You see, it's all about the money. It doesn't have anything to do with law. If he cuts on his lights behind you and pulls you over, he's declaring an emergency. If he's declaring an emergency, the first thing we're going to have to look for is, where is the injured party? Okay. If you file a valid cause of action, how many points are in a valid cause of action? Where's the injured party? Where's the injured party? Did you declare an emergency? Did you cut the lights on? Could you please provide the injured party? If you have the medical records and stuff, we would need a copy of that, if you can supply us with it, so on and so forth. Because it's all, just like the guy says, it's all a sham. It's up to you to continue to be robbed or not be robbed, okay? And we have solutions for you to keep from being robbed, if you so choose to select to stop being robbed. Because the prices of driver's license are going to go up. The price of the tags are going to go up. Price of insurance is going to go up. Price of the tickets, the different rules and regulations and restrictions that you're going through just trying to leave your house and go to your mama house. You got to slow down over here. You got to be careful going down here. You got to be, something might jump out. They hiding behind the building. It's nothing but, these are what's called highwaymen. It has absolutely nothing to do with law. It has nothing to do with justice, just nothing but robbery. That's all. Does anybody have a question? If you got a question, go ahead and raise your hand. I'm going to open up the line so you can ask your question, and we can see if we can get that question answered. Because that is the bottom line of the whole thing. Most of us think that when we see policemen out there on the streets, riding up and down the street, or we see the little speed traps and stuff, that they're actually trying to control some type of illegal activity or protect us from something. No, this is a jack. You understand? Anybody been on the streets, you know what a jack is? A jack is a robbery. That's all. That's the bottom line. It doesn't have anything to do with law. Nothing whatsoever. And definitely nothing to do with justice. Nothing at all. Okay?
Okay, everybody. The Hawker Archives Master Library is up and running again. For those of you who have gotten a hold of Tahawka's Archive Master Library, go ahead and either give me a call or forward me your donation ticket back to tahawka53@hotmail.com, and we'll get that thing to you. Also, for those of you who have not accessed this powerful library, go to www.newdebtelimination.com. That's www.newdebtelimination.com. Click on the donation page up top, and you'll see a complete listing of the packages and stuff that we offer. And, of course, Talk Archive Master Library is now officially listed, and we're back up and running. Okay? Peace.
Okay. Now, we're going to go back one more time to Mark Stevens and let him finish telling us about this and how to defend yourself against the highwaymen and the robbers inside the court. Now, we learned yesterday that they weren't even courts and judges. We learned that from a man that told you he got 35 years of experience in this thing. These are not courts. They're not judges.
Well, if you look at things as more as they really are, you're in a situation where you're forced to be there and has nothing to do with your consent. You got a guy with a robe on, you got a prosecutor, and then there's you. Nothing involves your consent. These are just men forcing you to do something. But they're pretending to be administering justice. Well, these are people with absolutely no voluntary support whatsoever, right? All taxation is compulsory, so government has no voluntary support. It's a really great question to ask a congressman or someone. Say, given the fact that all taxation is compulsory, do you have any evidence you have any voluntary support whatsoever? Now they're stumped. The only thing, well, who's going to build the roads? People. Next it. You know, that's why yesterday voluntarism is the easiest thing in the world to convert people to. They already are. So an example of this, in looking at the situation where they're just people and not accepting this ridiculous myth that they're honorable, okay, you can ask some very effective questions. They will actually dig the hole for themselves because they have to maintain a presumption of legitimacy. See, if we're in court, you guys are sitting here, if you're not buying with me, if I'm the judge, if you're not buying this crap, you're not going to pay me. So I got to do a good job making this look good, which I think I'm not doing a good job now. I'm failing now. So one of the things that we do when we go in there is to not be confrontational. A lot of the damage control is to get the idea out of our heads and out of our hearts, especially, that we're not here to fight. I call it in the book, Zen in the Art of Litigation, because you do not want to be a combatant. If you're argumentative, you're disagreeing with them, they're just going to disagree with you, and you've committed the cardinal due process sin. You've allowed them to be responsive. Being responsive is their only real obligation there for due process. Don't let them be responsive. So what I present, especially in a new book with an explicit model of this, what I present is an easy-to-learn model based on looking things more as they are. Because I'm sure if you saw a judge walking around here with a robe on and he started screaming contempt, we'd all start laughing at him. All right? There was somebody the other day doing that. It was hilarious. So when we go into court, and you can hear this when I did it with the tax hearing. So I have a contemporary example, a real-life thing, and you can hear how it really, really binds them up. And I don't have to quote the law. I don't even have to know the law, because I don't. Okay? I can't stand up here and quote statutes. It's not my thing. But you don't need to. And this is why what I do is teach people to be their own attorney. They don't have to use lawyers. They don't have to spend $250 to $500 an hour for someone to talk abstractions. And okay, and just make a deal. So what we do is we got the situation, we're not making any, and Gina, just let me know when I got 5 minutes left. So what we do when we go in is ask the judge if we're entitled to a fair hearing. And he's got to say, well, yeah, of course. We're Americans. We're fair. Great. Can I get a fair trial if there's a conflict of interests? Well, no, of course not. Nice. This is a bad spot to be in if you're a judge. So now I ask the judge, because we are, you know, through investigation, which I have a lot more on the website and the archives of the radio show, I'm going to, knowing what we already know, that's all a fiction, and how things work and what they're doing with these words, because it's all a word game, because let me just summarize, so you can follow. Am I entitled to a fair hearing or a fair trial? Yes. Can I get a fair trial if there's a conflict of interest? No. And then I say to him, sir, who do you represent here? Now, most of the time, they're smart enough not to answer this question. Occasionally, we get guys where it's going quick, and they stumble on him. So this happened in Keene. You can go to freekeene.com, and you can see John Arnold saying, State of New Hampshire. Now, you want to be real professional about this and play the babe in the woods. You got to play stupid. You got to be like them. Sir, I'm not an attorney. I don't understand here. If you represent the state of New Hampshire, if you represent the plaintiff, wouldn't that be a conflict of interest? Again, I'm not accusing him of having a conflict of interest. Just asking a question. So like somebody mentioned earlier, what I used to say all the time is, you're playing Columbo. So it could be one of these things. Can I get a fair trial if there's a conflict of interest? No. Okay. Just one more thing, sir. Who do you represent here? And so, this is obvious. He's already told me I can't get a fair trial if there's a conflict of interest. He's telling me he represents a party. He's saying it, not me. This is a judge. So like I say at workshops, I'm just a schmuck from Long Island. Who cares about what I have to say about the law? The judge with the robe on is the acknowledged legal expert. He's the one saying he represents the state of New Hampshire. And you've got, again, you can go online, you can see this, and I have where judges have said that too. So what do you think they do from this point? Is he calm and rational anymore? 5-year-old with a gun, right? He's screaming. So an otherwise rational, professional man who's asked who he represents is now in a fit of rage. Why? Because you're coming in and non-violently, non-contradictory, you're not fighting him. All you're doing is you're pointing out his many contradictions. And that's not to say we don't all carry contradictions, but we're not using guns to enforce them. He is. He doesn't deserve. He doesn't deserve any. what's the word here? Soft pedaling. It's a very volatile situation here. So a lot of times we're not worried that they just throw it out. And people will say, ah, that had nothing to do with the merit that Mark presented. It had no merit to it whatsoever. I don't care. I don't care if anyone, you know, who's a critic thinks there's merit to it or not. You can. It speaks for itself. It's not about me. You know, so if you listen or you see some of the trolls, it's always, it's the way it is with liberty. They attack the person. I might be an idiot. Ah, well, but what about the information? So what I talk about a lot is about a cause of action and that there has to be a legal injury. And they always come back and say, that's frivolous, that doesn't, or it doesn't apply here. It's a new legal standard, by the way. It doesn't apply here. Feel free to use that. That's, so... Well, we get that all the time. So when it, that doesn't apply here. Really? Can you cite that? Is there any basis to that? No, it just doesn't apply. Great, can I adopt that same legal standard there, tough guy? Okay, oh, a traffic ticket doesn't apply to me. Oh, a basis? Grounds? No, don't need it in the scorecard. Apparently here you don't need that. So I've spoken about this a bit, and I think it's a very important issue. I did a habeas corpus for Ian Freeman, who's a friend of mine who was put in prison, or put in jail, up in Keene, New Hampshire, for standing in front of a car for 45 seconds. So call it obstruction, say he's guilty of sin. Fine. Just give him a year in jail. And they suspended all but 90, and he did 60 days. So I filed the habeas corpus. In their zeal to not hear from me, which I can understand is a common feeling here today. But in their zeal to not hear from me, because I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a lawyer. Don't claim to be, don't want to be, not a lawyer. So to convince a judge not to listen to me and not let me say anything, because when we were in court, I confronted him. I need a point of clarification. So what we're going to do is we're going to play that clip now. This is from the Keene Superior Court. This is an illegal recording, according to Philip Mangione and Tom Arnold and these other guys. So this is an illegal recording of the habeas corpus hearing. It's only about a minute long.
All right. If the parties, counsel, et cetera, can identify themselves for the record, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. John Webb, appearing for the respondent.
My name is David Cocker.
David who?
Cocker.
Okay, and you're from Keene?
Yes, I am.
All right, and I believe by telephone we have Mark Stevens from Arizona.
Yes, good morning, Mark Stevens. And I want to, if I can get a clarification from Mr. Webb as far as who he's appearing on behalf of.
He's here on behalf of the county Department of Corrections.
Just when I'm reading his paperwork, it says that he's written here, now comes the state of New Hampshire buying through the office of the Cheshire County Attorney. Is he appearing on behalf of the state of New Hampshire?
Mr. Webb?
Thank you, Your Honor. As I said, I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent. I am.
Okay, just for a point of clarification, because this is an important issue, when he says he's appearing on behalf of the state of New Hampshire, is he talking about the body politic?
All right, let's not start with that, sir. His appearance has been filed as counsel for Rick Van Winkler. Winkler, we will proceed. If you do not feel I'm handling this matter appropriately, you may appeal.
Well,
thank you. Sir? Do not start with me. just do not start with it. All right, if the parties, counsel, et cetera, can identify themselves for the record.
Well, thank you.
Sir?
Sir?
Do not start with me. Just do not start with me.
Now, some people may say, why are you making such a big deal about this? Now, this is a man who's a friend of mine, but he hosts Free Talk Live. He's a real guy, just like us. He spent 60 days in jail. To have a legitimate, valid, or legal, constitutional, whatever, conviction against him, they had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt his presence within the state of New Hampshire. Does that sound like a pretty important thing to you? And you notice how they don't want to challenge, I can't challenge him. But what I don't have here in the clip, because it would bore you to tears, is the rest of the hearing consisted of him challenging me. Nice. So, say Mark can't do this, great. Why, sir, do not start with me. So, I want to finish here. So in their zeal, they will always give you something to use against them. So for example, when we have a witness declared incompetent by asking two questions, did you file a valid cause of action against me? Yes, I did. Okay, officer, how many elements in a valid cause of action? Objection! Calls for a legal conclusion. The witness is incompetent to testify. Great. Strike his testimony and the ticket. Thank you. So what they do is they turn around and deny. What you do is you don't fight. You turn around and you pick somebody. You, my Dago friend, you. Come up here and testify on my behalf. Because what happens is the judge freaks out and the prosecutor loses their mind. He can't testify. He's not qualified. Apparently that's not a requirement of this court. Because you just let the cop do it. So, effective damage control is using what they have spewed forth, the nonsense that they have vomited out of their mouth because they put the opinion before the facts. You can always turn it around on them. And that's what we've got here. I can't tell you. I'm almost as excited for this as playing in with the band. Anyone who's familiar with me knows that I talk about there has to be legal injury because the PR is the government was created to protect and maintain the individual right. So that's the basis of the jurisdiction of the court. Well, Mr. John Webb, after thinking it was frivolous, I will read it verbatim. It will be on the website. First, Mr. Stevens lacks standing to file a motion in this matter. He has suffered no legal injury. And he was nice enough to do the research for me and support it with a New Hampshire Supreme Court case. So what I'm encouraging people in Keene, New Hampshire to do, especially if Mr. Webb is your prosecutor, to file this with their motion to dismiss as an exhibit and use his own stupid motion against him. But that is effective damage control. When we're living a life of freedom and liberty and we're living more free, that's going to anger some people. And eventually there's always a risk involved. So what I try to do is minimize that risk so that we can all participate and do something to help bring about a voluntary society. So part of this comes in where I have my parking ticket traffic study, where if you want to participate, you purposely get a parking ticket and we will track the results. And we've got participants, many in California already, so don't, if you're in California, maybe not. But we've got participants all over the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and England. So really looking forward to this. But it's about damage control, limiting the amount of damage. We want to live free. We don't want to ask for permission, but we're going to invite trouble because they really tend to hate that. And so I appreciate the opportunity to come out here and talk to you. Again, my name is Mark Stevens. It's markstevens.com.
Okay, Morris, we're back. That's very, very interesting. And that is some of the tools that we can use by simply understanding what their position is and what their duties are and what they are supposed to do. Keep in mind that last night we dealt with the fact that these people, you have to restrict their ability to answer. not become combative, but if any of you have ever watched the, and this should be my favorite episodes when I used to watch TV, watch Columbo, because that was my favorite. My mother hated him, but I like Columbo. Just one more thing, sir. Could you? He never really gets off the case. When you think you got rid of him, no, you didn't. He's not going anywhere. Y'all
and minute, so we man. Live in a society where we don't understand what the game we're playing in, and we're losing. We don't understand the game because we haven't been taught the game. We don't even understand something simple like racism. I keep telling black folks what racism is. I go around the world and I ask blacks in various countries. I said, two people, stand up any place in the room. I'll give you $1,000 if you can tell me what racism is. I've never, ever had one that knew what racism was. Never had one. I said, what is racism? He said, well, it's bigotry. It's hatred. It's not getting along with people. It's bias. It's discrimination. All that wrong. Racism has nothing to do with getting along with people and liking people. Racism is a competitive relationship between groups of people who are competing for the ownership and control of resources, wealth, and power. That's what racism is. Racism never existed on the earth until the 1500s, when all of a sudden nine European nations decided to use black labor, black bodies, and black wealth out of Africa to get in a race. After Columbus had discovered America, supposedly, in quotes, in 1495, all of a sudden they got a rush to redevelop the Western world. So all these countries were in a race, a contest, competing to see who can develop North America, Central America, and Latin America. It was a race. It was a race, and everybody was in the race but black folk. Black folk never participated in the race. You were the prize, the boot, the loot that they used to empower themselves. See, they were buying blacks in Africa on a typical for $15 to $20 a piece. And they established a thing called a profit margin, a 15% return on investment. 1,500% return. So they were selling for $400 and $500 and got into the United States and to other countries. And that's why the whole banking system started off of slavery in Portugal. Again, and the whole system of capitalism started off of black slavery. Before that was mercantilism. The whole concept that you all are playing in with promotions and what's called marketing development came out of black slavery. And it was designed not for you to profit, but for others to profit. Everybody was profiting initially except you, and it has not changed. And so when I look at your program, and it says that you are marketing developers. I would say marketing means going into any environment, a site, a geographical area, and promoting a product or a service or a good to get an equal value for it. You're marketing. But it also stipulates in there that to be a marketer, you must have a market. So I ask black folk, where are your markets? Where are your markets? Where is the black market? And they said, well, doctor, we got a black market. Where is it? They said, well, it's all over the United States. And that's how much you get. Well, we got a $650 billion black market. And that's a lot of money. Wrong is not. It is not a lot of money. It's only a lot of money when it's aggregated. Scattered through the integration process, your money is nothing. It is chunk change. Because we don't plan to have power. That's why we continue to integrate and scatter our money. And then brag about how much money we got. And then we come up with magazines and research to tell everybody where to go get our money and how to get it. Nobody else is that foolish but us. You got to have a license to be that stupid to do those kind of games. You don't tell people how to come into your market and how to sell to your people and take your money and your economy out. That's called a capital drain. When I was assistant secretary in commerce, we would take I took trade missions around the world. Nobody would allow that to happen in their country. We would not let the Japanese come over here and do dumpings. Dump their automobiles in Norfolk and in Jacksonville, Florida. That's called dumping, which means you come over and take the wealth out of our nation and doesn't take anything back to Japan. When they come over and dump their steel from Korea, we had a balance of trade policy, so you can't do this. Everybody has a balance of trade policy except black folk. We'll let anybody come in and do anything for us because we haven't changed the slavery. We still don't understand the process. Every day, Burger King's and McDonald's trucks will come into a black neighborhood and dump hamburgers, Coca-Cola, and take nothing out. That's a balance of trade deficit. This country right now is suffering from a balance of trade because we've allowed it to happen since Bush has been in office. And that's why you cannot profit in the society because you got a capital drain. Nobody's ever taught black folk how to practice group economics. Your money is supposed to stay in your own country or in your own community and with your own hands and your own people and bounce at least 8 to 12 times. But we are the only people that absolutely refuse to do it. We won't do it. As a matter of fact, we are against spending money with our own people. And we're in that condition because meritorious manumission taught us in 1710 that a policy was set up in the Virginia colony and then also later into South Carolina. It's called meritorious manumission. Meritorious means to earn. Manumission means to release. So a black could earn his release from slavery if he did one of four things, or a combination, elaboration, or sophistication of those four things. One, if he could prove to whites that he could see things through the eyes of a white person, and he'd prove it by one, saving a white person's life; two, saving a white person's property; three, inventing something or improving the profits that he gets from picking cotton and corn or tobacco; or four, if he would squeal on and tell on any other black person who was trying to escape from slavery. That was called meritorious manumission. We still got blacks in America that's working hard and diligently to get meritorious manumission. They're working hard to make sure that they protect a white person's property. I don't care, and they protect it by any time you come out with an affirmative action program. I have the dubious honor of being the person who wrote that first affirmative action plan for the state of Florida in 1971 that went all over the country, a comprehensive plan. I didn't write the plan for minorities, poor folk, Asians, Hispanics, Arabs, midgets, humpbacks, lesbians. I wrote it for black folk. But immediately the whole frame of reference is the way you keep black folk down is always to loot and water something and make pretend it's for everybody. And that way anything for everybody is for nobody. And so they took that minority program, the affirmative action program, made it a minority program. And see, now I want the affirmative action program to die for that reason. In 1999, I go down to Texas, and a program is written for black folk. I look at the amount of money in state contracts in Texas that year, and white women got 78%. And nobody in our black leadership, in our black overclass, in the black civil rights movement ever said, hold a second, how are you going to put white women into a minority, into an affirmative action program set up for black folk when she was right along with the white man? She co-owned, co-controlled, co-influenced, co-inherited, and everything that the white slave owner had, she had it too. She sat in the same house, under the same table, slept in the same bed, and raised his kids. How is she entitled to be competitive with black men or black people in the society? But our black leadership didn't say anything, so white women went into the affirmative action program and took it over and dominated. That's why you go to check Coca-Cola about 3 years ago. Coca-Cola Company, almost 66% of all the money on the minority program went to white women. And in Texas, white women got 78%, and Hispanics got 21%, and blacks got 0.9%. Because, again, we don't know how to play the game. We keep buying into these myths about these very broad, ambiguous groupings. And all of that stuff started immediately after the Civil War. See, the Civil War, what they never tell you, and when I'm coming to a point on this with immigration, that in 1865, the first civil rights law was written strictly and solely for black folk to reverse the Dred Scott decision, which says black people don't have any rights that anybody's bound to respect. So they wrote the Civil Rights Law of 1865 strictly and solely for black people. And Andrew Johnson vetoed it, and they came right back, a few liberal whites, and they wrote the 1866 Civil Rights Law. Again, said it's strictly for black folk. And the Civil Rights Law had nothing in the world to do what you talk about today about civil rights. That Civil Rights Law was written for three things, and Congressman Benjamin Hatch and Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens And what they said is this, that there's only two things that the black person could ever be in America. You're either going to be slaves or you're going to be free. But you will always be a slave in America unless the black person receives minimally 40 acres, a mule, and $100. And you never got it. Because so that tells you where you are now. Nothing has changed for you. And so in 1868, they passed the 14th Amendment. It says, well, at least if you're not going to give black folks something, you need to protect black folks' rights. And the law then said it is mandated upon all levels of government to use all necessary means to lift the badges and incidents of slavery off the shoulders of black folk. Nobody has done it. That is a law. And at that time, the civil rights law said if you don't do it and you're in government, you go straight to jail. White or black. Nobody has carried out those civil rights laws to the present time. They were written for black folk. The 14th Amendment says that black folk must be treated in a manner similar to the way whites are treated under equal circumstances, similar circumstances. And in 1873, some whites from New Orleans went to file a lawsuit to use the 14th Amendment in the slaughterhouse case about the meat packers out in New Orleans. And in 1873, the United States Supreme Court came back and says whites cannot use those civil rights laws and cannot use the 14th Amendment because it was written strictly and solely to protect the rights and the freedoms of black people, people of African descent in America. When they said that in 1873, immediately the whole country exploded. And then the executive branch, the government, the judiciary with the courts, and the Congress got together and says, we got to end this right now. Because if black folk get smart and started using the civil rights laws and started using the 14th Amendment and started looking out strictly for themselves, they can be self-sufficient and competitive as a people. And they say, what we got to do now is to broaden and whiten those laws and pretend those laws are written for everybody. And if they're written for everybody, then black folk can't use them. See, that's how Barkey came up in 1968 and used the 14th Amendment. In the medical school exam say that it was reverse discrimination against him. That's why you see all these reverse discrimination court suits all over the country, because black folk now have walked away from their rights. You see, anytime you want to be a minority, a poor person, or people of color, or diversity, multicultural, you walked away from your rights. You're not entitled to any benefits. You cannot justify having an affirmative action program, having a Black History Month, having reparations for black folk if you're using those very broad terms. Because the minute you say you are people of color or you're a minority or you're diverse, what you're saying is no difference in the treatment of a black person in this country than an Eskimo or a Filipino just came in last week. And if there's no difference, then how are you going to demand something special or exception? How are you going to demand having a special week for black history? How are you going to demand to have reparations and affirmative action? When you go into the marketplace as a developer, promoter, you are not entitled to anything because you keep using the terms that says you're not anything different from anyone else. If your company is talking about diversity and multicultural and the more minorities, you cannot justify going into the black community and looking for black consumers or having black dollars specifically set aside for black folk. You just wiped out your whole history, all the history and the mistreatment and the slavery of your own people and ancestors by saying, I'm a minority, and if I'm a minority, I'm no different from anyone else. And so my people have never learned how to play the game. They keep going into the marketplace in a very broad, ambiguous terms, the concept that was used after the Civil War. And that's why we now keep talking about minorities. And so now we got a major problem in society that's going to wipe us out, immigrants coming into society. Because in 1970, for the first time, after the Civil Rights Movement was over, and there were some benefits coming to the table for black folk, those other groups figured it out. They figured out what my people hadn't figured out. See, because up to 1970, all the Arabs in this country, all the Hispanics in this country, they had, and then Asians in this country, they had been living with, marrying, and going to school with whites. On their driver's license, their immigration papers, they were classified as whites. But after the Civil Rights Act in 1970 and all these benefits for affirmative action came to the table, they said all we got to do is to break away from the people we've been getting benefits from and go against black folk. And now all these immigrants are coming out. They started in the 1970 census. They're now competing against black folk for resources. And they're going to wipe you out. Your leadership will not support you. They're all supporting more immigrants coming into the country. They're down on the border saying, y'all, come on, come on. And they don't understand. Let me give you a couple of points to them, and I'm going to give you some strategies we're going to have to start using. They don't understand that for every 10% increase in immigrants into this country, the people that are hurt are primarily black folk. White corporations benefit, black folks suffer. For every 10% increase in immigrants in this country, black people lose 0.3% of their income. I'm going to give it to you again. For every 10% increase in immigrants coming into this country, it's been going on throughout society for over 100 years, black folk lose 0.3% of their income. Now, since 1970 alone in this country, and I just told you, when all of a sudden these groups broke out, they figured they can go to the United States and get all kind of benefits. All they got to do is put one foot on the shore of America, and they're now entitled, they're now equal to black folk. They're equal to 400 years of suffering by black folk by just putting one foot in the United States. They're now entitled to go into affirmative action programs, get Social Security benefits, and get a free education and everything else. So since 1970 until the present time, the immigrants in this country have gone up over 400%. Now, if you multiply 400 times 0.3, it comes out to be 12%. Now, what's the impact of that? You go back and look at your census. You find out in 1950, when the civil rights movement started, and it started over this issue, that black folk were being underpaid. At that time in 1950, a typical white person in the United States was making $1. A black person was making 54 cents. That meant that a black person with a college education could not make as much as a white high school dropout. So a black person earned 54 cents to every dollar the white was earning. Now, because of the civil rights movement, black folk then got some new opportunities going into government jobs and some white corporations. So our income went up during the 60s from 54 cents up to 66 cents against a white dollar. By 1976, we went back from 66 cents back to 54 cents where we are now. Your entire civil rights gains in income was wiped out by immigrants coming into the country. Nobody's going to tell you that, but we're going to tell you through our think tank. Your whole income has been wiped out, and now the gap between the wealthy in this country is widening. The poverty rate is increasing, and most damagingly on blacks. So not only have you lost...
Okay, Moles. You had it.
Here's how he did it. He said, get the strongest nigger, male, and here's how you treat him. You bring him out and you bring, excuse the language, you bring the nigger female and the nigger baby, and then you tie this strong nigger's foot to a horse on this side and his other foot to a horse on that side. Then you tie and feather that nigger and set him on fire. And when the horses start pulling in two different directions, they'll rip that nigger apart in the presence of the woman and the baby. And her listening to his screams and begging for mercy, she'll know then she can't depend on him. Then you get another big strong nigger. And you bring him and you get your bull whip. And you beat him, you don't kill him, but you beat him within an inch of his life.
Come on.
Until he's crying and screaming and praying and begging. And when that woman sees the man in that state, she'll be psychologically frozen. And all her daughters will be like her. They'll come out independent. And the boys, they'll have strong bodies, but weak minds. And out of her instinct to protect her male child, she'll break that male child for us and turn him over to us. And we'll give him many fields of labor, but he will be
working for us, broken by her. And right now, in the South, this is South Carolina.
That's right.
Y'all know what I'm talking about. Some white man would come to your house, and you a beautiful young girl, and he would tell your father, send her out. He wanted to have sex with her. And the man had no power. He's frightened to death to resist. Gone, baby. And right now, you look at the plot. Black women fill in the colleges. Black men fill in the jails. Where, sister, is your man gonna come from? You at Benedict College. 69-70% female. 30-38% male. So the women outnumber the men, so you become a playground.
Come on, teach, brother, man.
Men playing with you. And you have lost so much respect for yourself that you allow a man to play with you. And then he go back in the dorm and talk about that bitch that he had. We have become so degraded now that when rap started in the South Bronx, it was young black men using the art of the spoken word, but that was rap.
That's right.
They were talking to young men about the condition, not ghetto life, but they were passing on germs of knowledge and wisdom in rap, but the money lenders and the corruptors saw money in this, and skillfully they turned it from conscious rap to gangster rap, and we began glorifying the gun, glorifying the lowest part of life in the hood, glorifying the sale and use of drugs and the snapping of a cap in your brother. And then they glorify beefs and whatnot between rappers and their posses. Willie Lynch alive and well, West Coast rap, East Coast rap. See, now we're against each other from the East, from the West, from the North, from the South. We're against each other in terms of color. We're against each other in terms of those who are educated and those who are not. We're against each other from those that have money and those that are not. And then those of us who get some status as a councilman, a senator, a mayor, we're just senators and mayors of the plantation. We are in the big house. We're the house niggas. And the ones in the field that don't have no job, they the field niggas. And here you are in college with an inferior education that will not allow you to compete in a global economy. This is real, brothers and sisters. Willie Lynch's stuff is real. It comes all the way up to preachers. They lie about how big their church is. Well, I have my church seats 3,000. Oh, that ain't nothing. Mine seats 5,000. See, it's that status thing again. You arguing over what? You got more followers. You a bigger preacher. You got more people listening to you. All of this is Willie Lynch. And then the envy of pastors arguing with one another, jealous of one another. Then the white Christian right take a black man and build him up, give him money,
put him on television, give him all kinds of backing. I've never heard a black man preach like T.D. Jakes. That man is anointed. But Bush called him. Bush, who messed up down there in New Orleans. He wouldn't even go down when it first happened. Then he come down, but he's like the Lone Ranger looking for Tonto to bail his raggedy behind out. So he brings an anointed man of God to clean his behind. Now, brothers and sisters, in my conclusion, this is a habitation of devils and a hole for every foul spirit. We can't walk the streets of Columbia like we used to do years ago in the South. In the South, we walk, we meet another black person. Good morning. You don't have to know him. Good morning. Good afternoon. How are you? Doors wasn't locked. You didn't lock your doors against one another. But today the spirit is so foul among us. We kill each other over a parking space. Kill each other over who won the shot when you're shooting crap. When you're gambling. I've seen black men killed over a burger. Human life means nothing no more. We weren't like this in the darkest days of slavery, brothers and sisters. We are worse now as a people than we have ever, ever been. And now I say to you all, God is angry with America, but God is also displeased with us. We've been playing with God and marketing Jesus like a commodity, but ain't nobody following him. See? Jesus said, if any man would be my disciple, he must first deny himself, pick up his cross, and then follow me, not worship me, follow me. We in church worshiping Jesus rather than following Jesus. In the book of John, Jesus said, God is a spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Jesus was not trying to get us to worship him. He was trying to get us to worship the one that he said was his father. And when the servant asked him, Master, teach us how to pray, he said, pray on this wise, our Father. Family, family, family. We are a long way off from God.
Okay, Morris, we're back. I wanted to add these plugs so that we would never forget, because quite so often we're dealing with this law and commerce and the commerce game. This was created by the Europeans, and they're doing their thing, but we are all within the confines of it. We deal with it every day with life, water, rent, cardinal, school loans, you name it. However, we must never forget who we are, okay? And we're always going to keep this in mind, so I want to add a little bit of this before we get in with more of the mechanics of how to deal with this thing and how to win with it, okay? So y'all sit tight, and we'll be right back in just a second. Deal with a little...
the best way to control melanated people is keeping them poor and disenfranchised, and this is what has happened to black people in America. There's a reason why black people have been economically undermined, because it's very easy to control poor people. When people are poor, you can do whatever you want to them, and they won't have the economic power to fight back. They won't have the economic power to put a politician into power to help them out. They won't have the economic base to really take care of their basic needs, so then you can control them any way you want to.
When you live in a poor neighborhood, you're living in an area where you have to have poor schools. When you have poor schools, you have poor teachers. When you have poor teachers, you get a poor education. And when you get a poor education, you are destined to be a poor man and a poor woman the rest of your life. Poor education, you can only work on a poor-paying job. And that poor-paying job enables you to live again in a poor neighborhood. So it's a very vicious cycle.
Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police departments. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people, you can't inform your people, you can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares?
This one ain't over. You got some more to drop on this one.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black women practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up, as I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. And up to about 1920s, black folk had the greatest economic achievement they've ever had in this country. Even though if it didn't occur under integration, it occurred under segregation. Those black folk had managed to acquire over 20 million acres of land, according to the United States Census in 1920. 20 million acres of land. But between 1920s and 1950s, they lost almost all of it. Back in the 1920s and up to the 1940s, we had black broom factories, we had black mattress factories. Almost every black major city had at least two cab companies. We had black bus companies. We had black shipyard up here in Baltimore. When I say black bus lines, I'm not talking about just having three or four buses. We had over 500 buses. And this is in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And our bus company didn't just service just the black neighborhoods. It serviced the blacks and the white neighborhoods. We had two black cab companies. We had the Harris Cab Companies and the Campbell City Cab Companies. But they used to have their own restaurants. They had the best nightclubs in the country. The blacks had two baseball leagues. Each baseball league had 8 teams. We had over 500 of the best baseball players in the world. But what did they do? They wanted to integrate. So as soon as they put Jackie Robinson on the Brooklyn Dodgers, black folks said, we'll give up all of our black baseball leagues, black teams, and all our black players, and we can just get one black boy to play on a white team. The black folks stripped themselves of all their resources. They stripped themselves of their unity. They stripped themselves of their role models when all blacks used to live together. Then they had their own role models. All the doctors and lawyers and teachers with the blacks lived all together. You had a sense of community. You knew each other. You trusted each other. You worked with each other. You participated with each other. You learned how to buy from each other, to sell each other, to support each other, to care about each other, to love each other. When black folk up into integration, blacks never locked their homes. Black folk on an aggregated national disposable basis of collected income, they might be the ninth richest nation on earth. Right now, if I take all the black folks' money annually and aggregate it, they might be rich. They're richer than maybe Sweden, Canada, India, Pakistan, a whole bunch of countries, Thailand, folks most all put together. But the difference is what I keep trying to tell blacks: it doesn't make any difference. Because it's not aggregated. You aggregate something, you strengthen exponentially the power of it by multiplying factor, by putting them together and then piling it up, making it stronger. But unfortunately, we are the only people that don't want that occur. Because, you know why? Because traditionally, whites saw black folk aggregate as being a negative. And we see everything through the eyes of whites. Typically, anytime anything that exceeds more than 6% of something is black, if white's in charge of it and you get more than 6%, that sets off alarm in the white society. If I move into a neighborhood and I'm the only black, whites will accept the one black, or the two blacks. But the minute you start getting up further than that, they go on alert. So by the time you hit 6, you know what happened then? They started putting their houses up for sale. If I go in an organization, I got one black in that organization, and it's an all-white organization, they'll accept the one black or two blacks. But the more blacks you come in trying to integrate, that becomes a threat to the dominant society. And they'll either move out of that organization, move out of that neighborhood, or even go to their school and take their kids out of school. And where are they going to move? They're not going to move to a more integrated society. They're going to move back with their own people. When a white person takes his kid out of an integrated school, he's not going to go and try and find another integrated school. He's going to take his kid to a segregated academy, a charter school, or an all-white suburb.
Window wenzani umbi kangaka tiza kwenzani umbi kangaka window wenzani umbi kangaka Jiza kwenza ni umbi kangaka Uya wabona bekola shanje Uya wabona magweka oya Uya wabona bekola shanje Uya wabona magweka oya mtana ushakia ngameva asingomeva italafia ailo mtana uyakutanda uko yanyiswa ezindongeni andikatali nomaguteni isana sami singonile andikatali nomaguteni isana sami singonile walila walila lomtana walila ushakenga meva ailo mtana uyakutanda uko yanyiswa ezindongeni andikatali nomaguteni isana sami singonile andikatali nomaguteni isana sami singonile walila walila lomtana walila ushakenga meva ailo mtana uyakutanda uko yanyiswa ezindongeni andikatali nomaguteni isana sami singoni andikatali nomaguteni isana sami singoni le mama iyo hi iyo hi yo ayo mama iyo iyo hi
Once you build those things, learn how to start practicing group economics. Group economics means that every nickel, every dollar, penny comes in your hands, make sure it revolves around and goes to other black folks' hands at least 8 to 12 times before it leaves. That means if you've got a black community, a dollar comes in, you go down to the black grocery store and buy your black groceries. The black grocery store owner, he goes over to the black barber and gets his hair cut from a black barber. The black barber then goes down and buys his car from a black automobile dealership. The black automobile dealership then goes riding a black cab. And you understand what I'm saying? We're supposed to be controlling like black hair. We're the only people got a certain texture of hair, thickness in hair. They call it curly or kinky, whatever you want to call it. Why is it the Koreans are controlling black hair care? At 85 cents out of every dollar goes to Asians, the Koreans. Why are Koreans and Chinese controlling black hair care and black hair care products? Because you're not practicing group economics. If I go to a Chinese place, and I ask them to buy something from black folk, they won't do it.
Welcome to The Advise Show, media with a common sense approach. So we have another story coming out of Florida, and the media sat down with the Klan, had an interview with them. Now I want you to hear something that's very interesting to me, who they have on the team of the Klan. Let's go ahead and roll the clip.
Tonight, Nine investigates the Ku Klux Klan, the notorious group associated with white supremacist views and violence against minorities.
Channel 9's Jeff Deal spoke with the man who oversees the Florida chapter of the Loyal White Knights of the KKK. He tracked its leader down after we noticed the hate group is ramping up its recruitment efforts in Central Florida.
Flaming crosses, flowing white robes, and hoods, these are the unmistakable symbols of the Ku Klux Klan. The KKK is the white supremacist group known for its extreme hate and acts of violence against black people in the last two centuries, including the 1951 murders of early civil rights leaders Harry and Harriet Moore in Mims.
I remember saying, I don't believe my daddy is dead.
Evangeline Moore was 21 years old. She was on a train from Washington, D.C. to visit her parents when on Christmas night a bomb went off in her parents' home.
They murdered my parents. And it was done because of hatred.
So what has happened to the Klan? In recent months, flyers started popping up across Central Florida recruiting for the loyal white knights of the KKK. The flyers even showed up at the Harry T. Moore home site around the anniversary of the Moore murders.
What you've seen is just the tip of the iceberg right now.
The Grand Dragon, who oversees the Florida chapter and a newer member dressed in the white hood, agreed to sit down with us, faces covered.
Why do you want your face covered here?
Because I care about my job.
They claim to be part of an invisible empire.
We have police officers, paramedics, judges, you know. They're everywhere.
And they say they're 1,000 members strong and growing.
When you start looking at numbers, you know, you start looking at the census and you realize whites are the minority.
That's why he joined a year ago. He's interested in preserving the white race. Both men claim the Loyal White Knights is not violent and insist it's not a hate group, even though they referred to minorities using racial slurs we've chosen not to put on television.
I'm not going to lie about that. Doesn't mean I hate them. We are just proud to be white.
They also insist they no longer try to harass or intimidate minorities. But for Evangeline, seeing the flyers was a painful reminder of her parents' murders.
It really made me very, very angry and hurt.
And she's not ready to buy into the claims that today's KKK is a kinder, gentler Klan.
What else are they if they're not a hate group?
Jeff Deal, Channel 9 Eyewitness News.
The Loyal White Knights of the KKK said the flyers dropped at the Harry T. Moore home site are just an expression of free speech. The NAACP president in that area says they've asked the sheriff's office to step up patrols around the Moore home site in light of this recent action.
So you heard the Grand Dragon talk about they have police officers that side with them. They have paramedics that side with them. They have judges that side with them. Now, anybody who knows the history of America, you know that has always been that way. And that's why we talk about these racist police. They are in the Klan, too. That's why some of them want to be police, because they can get away with beating us down. They can get away with killing black people or any other minority group, and nothing's going to happen to them. That's why black people get longer time in jail than anybody else. Because you got judges, especially in Florida, this guy is sitting up here revealing it, that they side with them. They're part of the Ku Klux Klan, and they're so much of a coward when the guy asked him, why are you covering your face? Oh, because I care about my job. Like, if you believe in your cause that much to hate other groups of people, then you should show your face. At least skinheads, they show their face. They put themselves out there. They don't hide. But you hide behind some hoods. But you talking about you so big and bad. Talking about you want to preserve, you know, your race. What that got to do with other groups of people? That's what I want to know. You know how you want to preserve your race? Well, start marrying your women and start having more kids. That's simple. What other groups of people got to do with that? I mean, y'all just want to just be on this campaign that just want to hate black folks. And what is it going on in Florida right about now? You got all this stuff with Jordan Davis. You have a Stand Your Ground debacle that happened with George Zimmerman. He got off scot-free of murdering Trayvon Martin in cold blood. The evidence right there just showing that he didn't have to do that. Now you got the Klan recruiting people. The Klan saying they got police in Florida that's on their payroll. Black people in Florida, you better watch yourself. The Klan's been telling you that they got Klan police. They got Klan judges over there. Watch yourself, because is not looking too good. And I saw a documentary, I even put it up on my website, that the Klan said that their membership is up big time now because of Barack Obama. So don't sit here and think that we live in a post-racist society. We do not at all. Because the Klan and people like them spew their rhetoric, you know, a lot of those talking heads at Fox News Channel, a lot of these folks that's in the Republican Party that spew their rhetoric but say, hey, I'm not racist. I'm just saying that this, that, and the third. But you're always using them cold words like thug and all this other stuff constantly referring to black people only. Nobody else can be a thug with just black males. You can have a college degree. You can be a doctor. You can be a lawyer. But you're a thug. No, that means the N-word. We all know that. We discussed that many times before. And if white people do not agree with your racist rhetoric, they're called liberals, all those liberals. Like, they just hate non-racist white people. They really do. And that's sad, because a lot of people don't even understand when you talk about the Klan, there's a lot of white people that got hung, too. There's a few white people even got killed behind fighting for some of the civil rights with Dr. King and with all the other people, because it wasn't just us that fought for civil rights. They even had some white people that fought also. But a lot of people do not talk about the white people that lost their life during the civil rights movement of fighting against the Klan and fighting against J. Edgar Hoover and his racist FBI organization during that time period. Now, if this doesn't prove to the rest of the country and parts of the world that America has not moved on from race, I don't know what more to tell you. And it's sad that it's 2014 and people are still breeding racists. They are teaching their children that come into the world that you need to hate other groups of people, not because they've done you anything, just because of color. And you know what? The guy that got involved because he's saying about the minority thing or whatever, it's inevitable that's going to happen, even worldwide. What could you do? You really can't do much or nothing about it. I don't know why, you know, there's an explosion of population, at least in the United States, of black and Hispanic children, because there are more black and Hispanic children in the U.S. right now around the age of 5 and under than they are white. I don't know anything about that. But looking at on abortion statistics, you know, white women do lead in abortions at 36% abortions. So that could contribute to it. Feminism contributes to low birth rates as well, especially maybe with some of the women, you know, in the white category. I don't know. But that's an issue that the white community needs to fix. It has nothing to do with the black community or Hispanic community or any other minority group. Fix your own problems if you feel that's the issue. We have nothing to do with it. Trying to hate us, trying to harass us, trying to kill us is not going to fix your problems. It has nothing to do with us. So I was putting this video out there just to let y'all know, in Florida, keep your eyes open. Hit me up in the comments, choose the commentaries, subscribe.
Okay, Moores, we're back. I hope by now we got this. We won't forget this part, no matter what we're involved in or what we're trying to do. We still know what we're up against, what happened in the past, and what we're still faced with in this country. But now, we're going to move on, and we're going to go and deal with Mary Croft now. She's going to come in and let us know what's behind the fabric inside the United States. You know, what's going on behind the curtain, okay?
Welcome to Red Eyes Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden, Scandinavia. On Thursdays and Sundays, we are here addressing important and interesting subjects with authors, researchers, and filmmakers on a wide variety of subjects. Our website is redicecreations.com. That's redicecreations.com. There you'll find news, radio, videos, links, and resources, our forum, and of course our member section, and much more. I'm glad you're here today. We have an important topic that we are going to focus on. We have author Mary Croft with us on the line. She is the author to a book called, really like this title, it's called How I Clobbered Every Bureaucratic Cash Confiscatory Agency Known to Man. And the subtitle is A Spiritual Economics Book on Money and Remembering Who You Are. We're going to talk about money and the concept of natural persons compared to artificial persons, words, law, government tricks, and much more. Mary's website is spiritualeconomicsnow.net. I suggest you head over there and do take a good look around. So it's great to have you with us online, Mary, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, and thank you.
Why don't we do like this? We could begin to talk a little bit about you for listeners who might not be familiar with you or your work. In regards to research and the work that you've been kind of doing, tell us a little bit about your background in this.
Well, you know, my background is probably similar to most of the rest of us who are doing this, and that is that we got beaten up in some way by the alleged authorities. Like somehow, somewhere along the line, something occurred in our lives and we said, hey, wait a minute. This just isn't right. There's something wrong here. We didn't know what it was, but we knew that we were not to be treated like this, whether it's anything from ridiculous traffic violations, whether it's incarceration, whether it's IRS, CRA, ATO, IR, you name it, where I don't know what your tax agency is called over there. Whether it doesn't matter what it is, we all came away from it saying, okay, there's something wrong, and that includes, you know, the banks foreclosing on your house, credit cards, collection agents ringing you and saying, you owe us this much, but you notice they'll never put it in writing. I mean, you just have a feel for it, and you say, okay, I got it. There's something wrong here. Something's going on that shouldn't be going on. And so you start investigating, and you start talking to people. And I, like everybody else, started chasing the best information. And then when I had a hint of it, what I did was I started experimenting, because I contended, and still do, that the cause of every single problem on this planet, and I mean every single problem that is on this planet, is caused from the infliction of commerce by the banks onto the people. The banks have destroyed what might normally have been a decent lifestyle, and I'm not talking the past 100 years, I'm talking hundreds of years. Now, that even stems back as far as the Crown and the Vatican. I don't really want to go back that far because, first of all, most of us weren't there. But for the last 75 years at least, we, by that I mean Western countries, have been operating in a state of bankruptcy. And, in fact, these countries do not even have a government. We've been without a government. We've had de facto governments, but that's not real, not de jure governments. And it's all because we've been operating within a bankruptcy, and that happened in 1933 when in the States and Canada anyway, and probably over there in Europe, you know, they did away with anything with which we could use to pay any debts. So what happened was the government essentially, the alleged government, said, well, seeing as you can't pay your debts anymore because we've withdrawn all the gold and silver and we're in bankruptcy, but we're not telling you that, we will pay your debts for you. But what happened was, although they designed a remedy, and they just decided not to tell us because it would behoove the banks to control the people of the world by enslaving them. And what's the best way to enslave them is to enslave or steal their labor and their lives. So people started believing that they had to pay for things when, in fact, we don't. And then what happened is, they started laboring, and the fruits of their labors, commonly known as dollars, got stolen from us because they essentially programmed us to believe that we're required to pay for things we need and want, and it simply isn't true. So we start going out trying to get better and better jobs. That's nice. And in order to get more cash, in order to pay them. But the thing is, there's two completely separate accounting systems, and we are not permitted to pay public debt with our labor, which is private. So they've kind of mixed up the two systems of accounting and enslaved us in the process. Now, there's a whole bunch of detail surrounding all that. So, I mean, you can start firing questions at me from there if you want.
Yes. I mean, there's so many areas, of course, that we can touch upon in regards to background to all of this. And of course, what you mentioned is going to be familiar with too many of our listeners in regards to at least the American, you know, version of this, so to speak, because in many contexts, too many researchers that are looking into these areas, they are primarily talking about what is going on the North American Union. So what I want to ask you right away, because we have a European audience, we have many people from Australia as well as in, you know, various countries around Europe and South America as well. But in regards to, let's say Europe then, you know, if these kinds of laws that you're talking about, either if we're talking about commerce or
other law, that this is something that is applicable in Europe as well as to the United States and North America.
Yes. Nobody in the Western world is operating under any law anymore other than the golden rule, and that is that we're not to infringe upon anybody's person, rights, or property. In other words, we do unto others. How we want to be treated, we want to treat others. So that's the only real law that there is. And everything else that we think of as laws are not laws. They're statutes, codes, rules, regulations, ordinances, bylaws, constitutions, legislations. What did I leave out? They have nothing to do with us. They are simply the policies of the corporations, which appear to be governments, but they're not. And let me use the USG as an example.
Mm-hmm.
The United States government is just a slick corporation, a foreign private belligerent corporation, which happened to be crafty enough to call itself the United States government. But it has nothing to do with what we think of as the country called the United States of America, nor is it a government. It's simply a corporation. And people actually think they're going to march to the polls and elect the president of this corporation. Well, no corporation in the history of commerce has ever had an election for their CEO's presidents. They're all appointed. Think of Sears Corporation. But anyway, getting back to your question, which
right.
is, that how does this apply in Europe, for example? Well, the only law under which we all operate is actually not a law. It's a code, and it's called the Uniform Commercial Code.
Yes.
They did away with any actual laws, which probably happened somewhere in the 30s all over the world. It was 38 in the United States, and I think before that in Canada. But anyway, somewhere around there. They did away with what's called common law, and they instituted the Commercial Code. And all the Commercial Code is laws under which we operate in commerce, which happens actually to be maritime commercial law or admiralty commercial law.
Yes.
It all just has to do with banking. There is no other law. There's no criminal code. There's no nothing. Nothing that applies to us. Those policies, laws, statutes, etc., apply only to the people who made them up for the corporation from which they come. So, for example, when a cop, stops you for going through a stop sign, well, show me the law. Well, there can't be a law that says that, unless I agreed to it, of course, and why would anybody do that? I'm not suggesting that people go through stop signs. I'm just using that as an example, that that's a statute that doesn't apply to men and women. It applies to corporate entities and the employees of those corporations.
Yes.
So the only laws that really apply are the codes of this Uniform Commercial Code. So we're all operating in commerce, and that means then that even the courts, into which some people actually believe they have to go, they're not courts of law, they're courts of commerce. So when they drag you in saying something like, well, did you murder this guy? Well, it's not about murder, it's about who has stolen whose credit and how much does who owe whom in order to balance the books.
Yes.
Simply bookkeeping. It's accounting. It has nothing to do with anything. It's not about theft. It's not about you name it. It's about accounting and how do we balance the books. And that's what the IRS, et cetera, is all about, is they're there to balance the books. And in fact, they're simply not the enemy that we've always thought they were.
Hmm.
That's a statement in itself, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes,
yes. Yeah, right. I know. We all hear about the IRS. In fact, just before you called, I was talking to a friend. And she's extremely concerned about, what's the IRS or the court now, because the issue's in court, what are they going to do? And I said, well, you got to remember, the IRS is only perturbed because you didn't file a tax return in order to get your tax returned to you, and now their books are out of balance and they're blaming you because they don't have the paperwork about how you ran your commercial affairs for that year.
Mm.
Now, if you'll simply let them know how you did that, they'll stop chasing you, and they'll start chasing the ones who actually stole your credit. And in this particular case, the courts stole her credit. So all she has to do is name them, and the IRS will go after the judges.
Hmm.
The way we want it. We're planning on putting the courts out of commission, because that system is actually contrary to what's really going on, which is we are operating in bankruptcy. Every country in the world, when it failed to pay back its debt to the IMF, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, it had to declare bankruptcy, because that's why they collected the gold and silver, is because they ran out of everything.
Is this applicable to all nations across the globe, you're saying?
Yes. Possibly not some tribes in the middle of Africa who still use wampum or whatever.
Right.
Not disparaging them. They're actually freer than we are.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Any country, and we're all working desperately on this to find the correct forms, and just in case your European listeners are wondering about what forms, I can't say this for certain, but we're beginning to think that people over there, and even Australia, New Zealand, and England, they might just have to get EINs, which are employer identification numbers, and also international tax identification numbers, known as ITINs, with the IRS, with Social Security, because it seems, I can't say this for certain, but it seems as if the IRS is kind of the head guy as far as collection agents go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody's heard of the IRS. Not everybody's heard of IR or ATO or whatever. What's your tax agency called there?
They're called Skatteverket.
Good grief.
Yeah.
No, you mean you don't even have an alphabet agency there? I mean, it's called Skatteverket. Well, anyway,
I guess it's SV for short or something. I don't know if they punch it down to letters like that, but anyway, there you go. Yep.
That's terrific. Anyway, but see, I haven't heard of that, but I'm sure you've heard of the IRS.
Yes.
So it's kind of like they're the big guys, because they truly are the best collection agent on the planet. Well, the truth is, they're supposed to be collecting for us. I know this is really, really hard to imagine. But whenever we have put our labor in the form of cash or credit card payments or debit card payments or money orders or certified checks or however it is, that's all from our labor. When we put that into the public, we're actually obstructing the bankruptcy. Because we're all acting in bankruptcy, in other words, the commercial code is based on and due to bankruptcy, we're actually in violation of public policy, and we're doing it wrong. We're not supposed to be paying anything with our labor. We're supposed to be setting off public debt with our signature, which means when somebody presents you with a bill, which, by the way, they tend not to do anymore because that is the easy way to set off public debt, they're supposed to actually, I mean, you go into a store and you buy a lawnmower. Let's pick on Sears. I always pick on Sears. Do you have Sears over there?
No, we don't, fortunately.
Well, okay, Sears is just kind of your classic store for everything, you know.
I know. Yeah, we have similar ones over here. We have that for sure.
Well, I always pick on Sears because for no reason other than I thought it was kind of worldwide almost. But anyway, so you go in there. What they're supposed to do when you take your lawnmower to the counter is they're supposed to write you up a bill that says who you are, who the Sears is, and the cost of the thing, and what it is, what they get. And what we're supposed to be able to do is simply sign for it, thereby claiming it, and giving them access to what's called a treasury account so that we can let the treasury know to offset Sears' debt, which Sears created, by the way. We didn't create it by buying the lawnmower. They created it. They wrote it up as a debt, and all we're doing by signing the bill is saying, I'm authorizing the Treasury to balance your accounts for you, because I now know you have a debt, so you want it balanced. But for us to pay with cash, our labor, believe it or not, is actually increasing the debt. It's doubling it because the amount's the same. Then they give you a receipt which shows you that you've paid. Well, in fact, this did not set off their debt. It increased the problem because we gave them debt notes. Now, this is a huge, long diversion, which I don't really want to get into, but when we labor, we are putting forth our value, and what we're getting in return is debt notes. In other words, those notes operate in debt. It's kind of like picture the level of seawater. Well, there's nothing. We are putting in something positive, so imagine the sea going up, right?
Mm.
But what they're giving us is something negative, so now we're operating below sea level. So it isn't direct compensation. In fact, we are giving away our labor for nothing. What's that called? Slavery. So this is how they've enslaved us, by pretending to give us something of value that isn't of value. And yet, it's true, we can go and get what we want with that. But we're not supposed to. We're not supposed to be handing over that cash. We're supposed to be setting off public debt with our signature and using cash simply for items between you and me. Like if you want a haircut and I say, hey, I can cut your hair, Hendrick, so you say, come on over. And then you say, well, how can I compensate you? And I can say, well, let's see, you could invite me for supper. That would be a nice compensation. Or, let's see, or, oh, you know what, if you don't want to have me to supper, you can just give me some of those notes that you have, that you get from working. And you say, fine. And I take those and I can do what I want with them.
Mm-hmm.
Go someplace and get something else. So, but not in the public, just the private. In other words, then I could maybe use my friend's computer for the day, and he says, well, how are you going to compensate me? I say, well, I got these notes that Hendrick gave me. So that's how that's supposed to work. We're not supposed to put those notes into the public. We're supposed to be able to walk into any store. They write us up a bill. We set it off by signing our name, which actually instructs the Treasury to set off their debt. So that then, of course, they can go buy whatever it was I just got from them, like the lawnmower. They go back to their supplier and they get them a lawnmower, and they use their account to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've been credited. Now, stop me if it gets too crazy, because I know everything is absolutely the opposite of what we've been thinking.
Yes, yes.
So,
I mean,
yeah, I know it's a little dingy, but
it's fine. But let's go back a little bit more and go over it, kind of the overview once more here a little bit, because if we think of money right off the bat, obviously it's a means of exchange. It's better in a way, or easier, I should put it, to carry around like, let's say, paper money instead of carrying around you know, coming with your, you know, tractor, whatever it is that you want to exchange, right? You know, so in that regard, we can think of money as a kind of a symbolic means of exchange. But what you're talking about right here now is that money has been transformed into something else. It no longer represents the true value of what it's supposed to be. Is that correct?
Yes. It does get us what we want, as you say. We don't want to walk around with a tractor in our pocket, so we carry cash. But that's just between you and me in the private. But when we go to work, it's true they're giving us that, but we were never meant to earn our living anyway. And that gets into a whole ethics issue, where what we're supposed to be doing is whatever our talent is. And we all have a talent, whether we've realized it or not. And so we're supposed to be doing that. I mean, there's carpenters out there. There's people who build lovely furniture. There's people who make lovely music. And so what they ought to be doing is doing that for their fellow man. And when their fellow man says, oh, I just love this piece of music that you played for me, or this desk that you built for me, what can I do for you? And then he says, well, you can do this for me. Or if you can't, or you don't want to, or that's not appropriate right now, tell you what, just give me some of those notes and I can take them someplace and get something from somebody else. In other words, we're not even supposed to have these corporations in our lives. They shouldn't even be existing, but the reason they're existing is essentially to confiscate our labor.
Yes.
And they've enslaved us instead of, so we're not working for ourselves anymore and each other. We're working for major corporations, and we're simply cogs in a machine there, and we're not serving anybody by doing it. Because most of the people who work, I mean, you look in any city and you can see these skyscrapers, what are people doing in there? They're not doing anything for their fellow man. They're either doing stockbroking or insurance or banking or something that has involved them, rather enslaved them, in the commercial world. There's no good being done from any of these corporations. Now, yes, these corporations do supply us with the goods that we want. And that's where we say, okay, it was my value that funded the manufacture of this because I have a birth certificate, and because you knew that, and by that I mean the alleged governments,
yes.
What they did was they used the birth certificate as a bond in order to create the credit manufacture whatever the corporations, in other words, create the corporations and manufacture whatever it is they sell, so that we could simply saunter in there anytime we want and say, I'll take that right there. And
area code 412. Tell me who you are, what's on your mind. 412, area code.
Hey, hi, Brother Tarkus, Lisa. Hey, I got the email late, but I tuned in as soon as I looked at it, and I don't, what is that lady's name that's talking?
That's Miss Mary Croft.
I figured
she wrote
that.
A book.
You know what she was talking about kind of put me in mind of what you were telling me about that brother that doesn't use money?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Oh,
she does it all
the
time.
I was dumbfounded when she said, oh, no, you just go get the lawnmower and they send the note, the bill to the treasury. That's amazing.
Well, that's operating on the private side because what I've been attempting to do is to get people to completely and totally understand the background and the fabric. And you have to tell people over and over and over and over again, you know, until they get it. You know, I can say it until I'm blue in the face, but if I feel like if I keep getting people to understand that there is no money, there is only credit, and the most valuable thing you own is your signature inside the United States. And the birth certificate is a bond. Now, you couldn't open up the information on how to collapse a bond, right?
I couldn't get that open.
All right. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back, and I got a guy. He's going to start from start to finish. I won't be able to do it on this broadcast because it's about 30-something minutes, but he's going to start and tell you the same thing that Mary Cross is telling you, and then he's going to tell you how to actually get in position. And then, of course, we got the step-by-step how to collapse the bond and operate this way. I mean, I've had the actual documents for the longest, but I've been so busy trying to wake my people up, I ain't had time to even do it for myself, but I'm going to get around to doing it. And
okay.
But now it's in a nutshell. It's in video format. I'll throw it up in the library. And we're going to bring this guy in. But Mary Crawl, she wrote the book How I Clobbered Every Bureaucratic Confiscatory Agency Known to Man. And she's quite interesting. She uses both hemispheres of her brain. And she beat up some of the biggest banks on the planet, and to the point where these major banks would go and get collection agencies. And the collection agencies would contact her. And she was like, well, if the biggest bank, this big giant bank could do anything with me, what makes you think you can? And I just politely throw them under the bus as well. But she's inside the archives. The book is in there. And if there's anybody that don't have the archives, if you want a copy of that book, to just send me an email at tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll send that to you as an attachment, and you can read it for yourself. And that it's quite interesting in this. She's pretty major.
Tahaka, when is that brother going to be on? Because I don't want to miss it. Like I said, I got the email about this show late, and I'm really upset with myself, but I don't want to miss that brother. When is he going to be on?
Brother Aleem Bey, I got contact from them today. He's going to be on Thursday.
Okay, Thursday.
He's going to be on Thursday. So I'll get with him prior to that and make sure that we got everything done up. For him to come back on, I got a few more to contact in between now and then to get these other guests on here. And they'll be on Thursday. This is the word that I got. If nothing don't change, this is the word I got today. So Thursday.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm going to go on and continue with a little bit more of Mary because Mary gives a breakdown.
Okay.
All right.
there would be no how are you going to pay for it, because I already paid for it. It was my credit, my future labor and productivity, my value backed by the bond that was floated against the birth certificate that actually covered the cost to make the lawnmower that I just came in to buy, or to get, actually.
Mm.
So for them to say you owe us, they say, well, what are you smoking? It's prepaid. I already paid for it. And the example I use in my book is, if you have a friend, let's say that I get confused on that stuff. Okay, you come to me and you say, Mayor, I'm just about to open a restaurant, but I need the last $10,000 to do it. Can you lend it to me? I say, sure. You say, oh, I'll pay you back with this much interest, and here's when. And I say, fine, away you go. You finish your restaurant, it's absolutely perfect, but you're not doing quite as well as you planned. So, you know, 6 months later, you come to me and you say, uh-oh, we're just squeaking by, but I can't pay you back the $10,000. And what was the interest that I said I'd pay you? You know what? I just don't see this happening. How can I make this up to you?
Mm.
I say, well, I don't know. And you say, look, tell you what. Anytime you want to come and eat in my restaurant, just when the waiter hands you the bill, you simply put your signature on it. I'll know it's you. And then I'll say, oh, thank God, Mary is claiming back some of her credit, some of what I owe her. And that's exactly what the government ought to be doing through its government-owned corporations. Let's go back to the lawnmower. We go in. When Sears sees my signature on their bill, they should be saying, oh, Mary's claiming back the credit that we took from her in order to make the lawnmower in the first place.
But then you're...
Even exchange.
But then you're talking about that you, as a human being, when you come into or enter into this world, that you have a right, so to speak, to sustain yourself as a human being, right? Because there have to be some kind of foundation, so to speak, on this. Because what you're talking about, I mean, you were obviously talking about like things like slavery before. I mean, I guess we have to as well also kind of go back into history and just look upon how one human being enslaves another, and that's kind of the initiatory step towards this kind of which at this point is an international system of slavery and control, basically, that we're looking at, you know.
Mm-hmm. So is your question, how all of a sudden do I get this credit?
Well, my question is, I guess, how, just to clarify for our listeners, when you say that you know, when you go into the store and to get that lawnmower, that actually already is prepaid. That you actually have paid for it, or you have a right to take it as yours. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yes, I am. And are you asking why?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's do it again. Only those with birth certificates can do that, because what happened in the 30s was mothers were obliged to register their babies' births, because then what the feds, the government, the alleged government, said was, we now know of this other child that's been born, and it's been registered. It's now a corporation, because the name on the birth certificate certainly isn't the name of any baby.
And we need to go through that later, but yeah, continue your story, yes.
Yeah. So what they've done is, well, they've just simply created, they've registered a name for a corporation, that's all. And so then they send us the birth certificate essentially saying, this is your ticket, this is what you can use to prove that you have unlimited credit from the Treasury. And the reason is because over your lifetime, we intend that you will pay us way more than we will ever pay you. So we're making it unlimited because we need your value in order to pay off the national debt, which of course doesn't really exist, but the concept is that if indeed the World Bank lent governments money, then it has to pay it back with interest. The interest, of course, doesn't exist. That's another subject. But so essentially what they said is, throughout your life, you'll pay enough in fines and taxes and fees and application, and you name it, that we will collect enough of your dollars in order, essentially, to enslave you. You will be slave laboring. We will get so much more value from your work, and that's why women apparently don't get quite as much credit as men, but that's questionable. But anyway, so they're anticipating getting way more from us. So what harm does it do them to say, you've got unlimited credit? The trick was they didn't tell us that we had unlimited credit. So here we go blithely along slave laboring due to this alleged national debt. We don't owe anybody anything. And they're taking our value where the remedy actually has been written into, well, here it's the Bills of Exchange Act, but it's been, the remedy has been written in, and the remedy is, because we're using your credit, unbeknownst to you, we have to have a remedy, because otherwise it would be unlawful, and we'd be in deep trouble. So we're going to create a remedy, but we're not going to tell you. But the remedy is, everything you could ever need or want is prepaid, because we used your credit to create the corporation, and we used your credit to manufacture the goods that you'll want. All you really have to do is sign for them, because we're getting way more from you by slave laboring in a bloody insurance company. And who's that work for? That's for the bank.
So
many of those downtown buildings are strictly make-work projects in order to pay off the national debt to the World Bank.
Yes.
Utter insanity.
So what you're saying here is that on the surface, so to speak, this is what the... If you sit down, study the system, right, and learn all the terms and all the linguistics and all the tricks, as it were, of the system, you discover that this is the reality of it. And if you can understand that, are you saying then that there is a way that you actually can do by law this to function, you know, in your lab? Can you go into a store and actually just, you know, make this happen, so to speak, get that lawnmower?
You can, but you got to remember that the employees of the store won't know what in hell you're talking about, right?
Right, right.
So why get into a dissertation? That's not our job to educate. We don't stand there and say, well, look, why don't you know that we have this blah, 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 unlimited credit, and this is mine, and all I have to do is sign it, and you take it to your head office and balance the books on it, blah, blah, blah. No, we're not going to bother with that. So what we're going to do is go along with them and say, here, what do you want? You want my cash? Okay, here. Now what we do is we, at the same time, this is, now I'm going to use U.S. terms only because that's sort of the biggest, sort of, and I know the form names.
Yes.
But so what we do is we hand them a copy of what's called a 1099 OID, and you don't need to know that other than what it does is it states who is issuing the credit. It's essentially stating that I am the source of the credit, not Sears.
Mm-hmm.
So, because if we just hand them our cash and we don't say who it is, they'll say that they're the source of the credit, and then they call it, it gets a little technical here, but they call it abandoned funds, and then the IRS won't tax them. They'll come back and tax us in order to balance its books. But that's a bit complicated. So here's the drift. So we give them certain forms. One of them is this OID, and another one is a 1040V, which is a voucher. And by the definition of voucher is a payment. And so all that means, or actually it's an authorization of payment. So then you send that to the Treasury, and you give these people a copy so that they know what you're up to. You get their tax identification number, and the Treasury sets off their debt for them. And then, of course, they've got, not only do they have it set off by the Treasury, they've still got our cash, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they say, oh, now we got this cash. Well, what the IRS will do is simply go back to the company and say, okay, your debt's been set off to you, and we now know that you have somebody's cash that you're not supposed to have, so give it back, and we'll get it back for the one who bought the goods.
Hmm.
So essentially, the purpose of the IRS is actually to track down what we have put into the public and get it back for us.
Hmm.
But we have to be very careful to give them the correct forms in order to do that. So
okay.
It really is a case of, going into the store and setting off the debt. But because nobody knows that, because they've been so programmed in school that they have to pay for everything, they presume that we have to pay for everything.
Well,
and try walking out of a store without paying for something.
Yeah, there we go.
So if you give them whatever it is they want, then you can just go back and say, look, I'll give you this, but I'll get it back from you later. Not to worry. This is not my job to educate you on commerce.
Right, right. But so what we kind of get back to here then is the fact that It doesn't feel like the system has been set up in order to operate in this case, at least not for the the guy or gal walking down the street, so to speak. This is the system feels like it is actually designed in order to deceive us, and this gets us into the other aspect that you were talking about, that this has to do with indoctrination and that everyone just goes along what their parents taught them or whatnot. But I mean, even if we were to come up to a point where we discover this and we learn how the system works, then it feels like they would actually just change the system into something else in order to sustain the control over us, if you know where I'm going with this, so to speak. Do you follow me?
I do. Now, and this is the problem we've been having for so long, up until recently, what we have been doing, like let's go back to Sears and the lawnmower, and if they did it properly, and I know they're not, but we'll get to that, they would hand me a bill, and I would sign it. That is the proper way to do it. But the fact that they're not, yes, and it's like it's more insidious than all that. I mean, what we've been doing with those bills or receipts, like just to say the electric bill. So we write on it, accepted for value, which means I accept your charge. No skin off my nose. I accept what you're saying. You're saying I owe you $100. That's okay. I'll accept it. I'll sign it, and I'll give it back to you. Now, what's been happening? Here's where we went wrong. What's been happening is they've realized that that is credit, and they've been stealing it from us. And we haven't had any recourse to go back in and say, hey, you stole my credit. And, of course, then you get another bill from the electric company saying you didn't pay us. And we're saying, oh, yes, I did. I accepted your bill, and I even gave you my signature, which means you should have gotten paid. But we weren't really clear on who was doing the set-off. So what was happening is we were giving them our credit, and they were winning, and we had no way to say, hey, wait a minute. So that's why what we're doing now is saying, yep, I accept your charge. Here's my signature, and here's the IRS forms so that you know that I'm going to go tell the IRS that I paid you with my signature. I'm going to send this document to the Treasury so that the Treasury will set off your debt, and I'm going to let the IRS know that I've done this. Now do you want to try stealing my credit? No, I didn't think so. And that's what's stopping it. Now, if for some reason they still think they can do this, what we're doing is, and I don't speak for myself, I have yet to do this, but people are filing commercial liens against these corporations who are stealing our credit and not essentially balancing their books. They're still coming back after us for the credit. And by the way, the best way to access this Treasury account is via what we call here in the provinces the social insurance number, and what they call in the states the social security number. And so I don't know what your socialist number is called over there. But that's the number that we sign with. In other words, when we write on a bill accepted for value, and then you sign it, and then you put that number and you send it to the Treasury says, okay, this is a real account. I can see that the name and the number match. So that's a real account. So we'll go into this unlimited credit account and offset the public debt for that corporation or the electric bill or whatever it is.
Yes.
And so that's how they know. So in a sense, that social, what we call a social insurance number, truly is an insurance policy.
Think of if
I ran into the back of you with my car, you'd want to know my insurance policy number, right?
Yes.
Well, of course, my question has always been, why do we need separate auto insurance when we already have a public hazard social insurance number? So all I really need to give you is that government number, and then you should be able to access my unlimited credit from the Treasury account and get your car handled. So they're not honoring that social insurance number would be the same as your getting my insurance policy number from me after I smacked up your car, and you're going to the insurance company and saying, Oh, well, Mary crashed into my car. Here's her here's the number. Here's my claim. Pay me. And the insurance company saying, no. Then what would you do? You'd come back to me, and you would say, pay me. And I'd say, I already told you who's going to pay you. I gave you the number. I gave you the company. I gave you everything you need. Are you trying to tell me that my insurance company didn't pay your claim? And you're saying, yes. And so now what do I have to do? I have to go after the insurance company, right?
Mm.
So that's kind of what's happening. Let's just say with a traffic ticket. You get a traffic ticket and you accept it and you sign it and you put your social insurance number on it, your whatever your socialist number is, and then what happens is the traffic guy or the court, the cops, they say, you didn't pay. And then, so our recourse is to say, well, I gave you the number of the insurance policy. Did you contact them? Are you saying that you didn't do that?
Yeah.
Or are you saying that they declined to pay you? Well, chances are the insurance company didn't decline. It's more likely that you did not go to the insurance company because you're hoping to soak me.
Hmm.
So if you can use that as an analogy, you can see how absurd it is.
Mm, yes.
So it'd be the same as you're calling me saying, well, your insurance company wouldn't pay, so now I'm coming after you. You think I'm going to pay you? No. Hey, your problem is with the insurance company. My premiums are paid. Now you've got a problem. So that's what we have to say to the courts is, did you access my treasury account? Well, they're not going to say no, but they will continue to come after us. And, of course, our point is, why are you bothering me? I gave you the number.
Hmm.
I told you how to get paid.
Mm, yeah.
So too many people are forking over their labor when, in fact, they don't have to. They simply have to say, hey, I gave you the number of the account. Did you go to the Treasury? But, see, the real drift is not that they actually have to go to the Treasury, and this is why I'm talking about this latest information. What we have to do is authorize the Treasury to offset their account, to set off their debt for them. So we were actually missing a very valuable step. We were sort of saying, here's my signature in my account, way you go. And now we're saying, no, they'll steal it and still come back on us.
Hmm.
Now we're saying, give me your tax ID number. Here's the forms. I'm sending the forms to the IRS. I'm going to authorize the Treasury to pay you, and the IRS is going to know that I paid you, and they're going to come back after you for it. Kind of like, are you sure you want to do this?
Hmm. And you are looking into a way to do this then, and a consequence of this. I mean, what would that be if let's say that everyone did this? Would this imply that the system actually would kind of self implode on itself, or the once the cat is out of the bag, so to speak, and everyone knows this, the system wouldn't be able to sustain itself anymore? What do you think?
No, it would start to act smoothly. And I write this in my book, too. I don't know if you're familiar with the Mayan calendar, but it's quite fascinating.
Yes.
I think it had something to do with dates. It doesn't, or that it measured time. It doesn't. It measures creation. But this year, 2008, is what they call the fifth night. And the fifth night is the end of manufactured lack, which boy, what a tip-off that is. I could never figure that out 5 years ago. I thought, I wonder what that's going to look like.
Yes.
Now we know what it's going to look like. People are going to start obeying commercial code because we're going to stick them to it. So in other words, when you say what's going to happen, it'll start running smoothly. There won't be people with no money and losing their houses because we now know how to essentially pay off the banks by telling them, hey, you stole my credit. You owe me, not the other way around.
Wait a minute, Mary. This is very interesting. So what you're saying here is that the system then would actually work in a more, in a more balanced and harmonious, so to speak, way, if this were truly followed to the standards that it was initially set up to be. Is that correct?
What I wrote in my book is that we live in a system that was designed not to work, and that's actually not true, if I could go back and rewrite it. Right? we actually live within a system that was designed to work. Everything is in place for this to work properly. What's happened is we've gotten some rogue agents in there, fell for the party line, which was everybody has to earn his living and pay his own way, and it simply isn't true. We're the ones who own the planet, so to speak. You can't own a planet, but
sure.
We're the ones in charge. And these rubby little bankers just simply had a scathingly brilliant idea on how to enslave the people of the planet.
So this is a way for them, for the those who set up the banks and so forth, this is a way for them to kind of hijack, if you will, an existing system and kind of applying a different layer, so to speak, on top of that system that was set up to begin with. And in order, when they do that, I should say, they manage to get rich themselves of the system and consequently also maintain or gain, I guess, control over, nations, I guess we can say at this point, right?
Yes. And the reason is, I spell this out in my most recent article, which is called The Two Accounting Systems. It's kind of weird, and it has to do with the fact that cash is debt, but corporations see it as credit. But in fact, it doubles the debt. But keep in mind, the board of directors want the cash because they use cash the same way we do. So it's kind of like the corporation is what twists things. If you and I pay our electric bill to ABC Electric, and we pay in cash, what we've actually done is give ABC more debt. Instead of paying off the debt that they created, like the bill that we get,
yes,
we've actually doubled the debt. But because they perceive, it's not what the corporation wants. Is double the debt. The corporation doesn't want to double debt. But keep in mind, corporations can't show a profit. So where does that cash go? It goes to the corporate board members. Because keep in mind, a corporation is a fiction.
Yes.
And so it doesn't have any feelings either way. But it doesn't set off the debt. When we pay our electric bill, it actually makes the situation worse.
Hmm.
So what happens is, board members who like cash just as much as we do, they take the cash and create double the debt. Well, what does double the debt do? It creates what's called the national debt. And that's the old, Americans are in so much debt.
Yes.
Well, no, we're not. The corporations are in debt.
Hmm.
Because that's how they want it. Because they want us to continue to fork over our cash to them. Because they can use cash, the people, not the corporations.
Sure.
It's kind of a switch. Like, corporations need credit, not debt.
It's exactly, and it's
who run them want debt, not credit.
And it's a kind of the system at this point, or the way the system or the structure is being used, is that it's gonna self-implode or pop like a bubble sometime here. It feels like, because in a way, then this means that they have to gain more and more and more and more debt, basically, in order to pay the previous debt. But this is going to, again, bring in more debt. So it's gonna pop, right? The bubble's going to pop.
Well, not if we call their bluff, which is what I think is going to happen. I don't know if you're familiar with George Green.
Yes, I've heard of him, yes.
Have you? Yeah. Now, he says watch out for September 30th, because that's the U.S. fiscal year. By that, I mean the fiscal year of the corporation called the United States government. Keep in mind, it's not a government. It's a corporation called that. So what he's saying is watch out. And I say, well, we got a little under 60 days to call their bluff and say there is no national debt. All you're saying is that every time we've given you cash, of course, we can't pay the interest because the interest doesn't exist, right? If they only create so much cash and they want interest on it, well, how can you pay something that isn't there, right?
Yes.
And if, just in case you don't grasp that, that would be the same as my borrowing your car with a full tank of gas and bringing you back more car than I borrowed. It's an impossibility.
Right.
So when banks lend you money and want interest back, well, where's the interest?
Yes.
unless they create it, and they're not going to do that without charging you interest, right?
Right.
So it's just this laughable circumstance. And I contend that if we can get enough people, especially those who think they're about to lose their houses with foreclosure, if we can get through to these people and say, You don't owe the bank. The bank owes you. They've been using your credit for however many years, and they've never paid any tax on it. So they owe us. So then, you know, we sick the IRS on them and say, go in and get my credit for me. Because the promissory note that most people use to get the loan for the house was the payment for the house right up front, right in the first place. Why? Because you put your signature onto a piece of paper. And remember, the signature is worth, well, billions. It's unlimited credit. So they took that promissory note and they converted it. And they've been selling it and using it. So the bank's gotten paid like, oh, who knows how many times. And they also want us to pay every month?
Yes.
So people have been going back in and getting not only the value of the note, but also the monthly payments. Imagine having everything you've ever put into your house come back to you in the form of a check from the tax agent. It's fabulous. Anyway, and of course, yeah, right. So, you know, all you're looking for is an updated, well, we won't go there. But anyway, so will the system implode? Well, we could say yes, and that's good news, or we could say no, it'll simply start to operate the way it's supposed to. But, you know, just like a cornered dog, they may not go down nicely.
Right,
right. They may fight and to the bitter end, even though they know they're losing, and it may get a little bit uncomfortable, and there may be some casualties.
Okay, Morris, we're coming to the end of the broadcast. We are going to come back and pick up with Mary Croft and go all the way out to the end with this thing. She has 11 plugs. We only did a few, and we got a lot of riding to do. So we will come back tomorrow night with part three, because there are other stuff here that I haven't gotten around to unloading as well. And so make sure you tune in tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Morris Talk Live 100 so you can finish getting this stuff because this stuff is a blockbuster. The lady puts it in a nutshell. It's been quite a while since I've listened to her and got a book and all that good stuff too. And so you make sure that y'all tune in tomorrow night.
On that show?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. We're going to come back.
Okay.
We'll do part three because there's some other stuff that I want to put in, but I want to finish up with Mary. We'll start off where we left off at, and we'll ride on out with her, and then we'll bring in the rest of this stuff. But for those of you, one more time, who would like to get a copy of Mary's book, just go ahead and send me an email at tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll send it to you as an attachment. Okay? Tahaka53@hotmail.com. Okay? You hear what she said about that mortgage lease?
Oh, brother. Oh, brother. Oh, brother. Woo! Yeah, I heard it.
Okay. Well, make sure you tune in tomorrow night. I'm going to shut this thing down because I've been up all morning.
All
right, then.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Moors, I've been your host, Tahaka Amani L. Bay, and until next time, you all have a good night. Yeah?